Ali is a new member, and he's also been recently appointed the Work Culture Committee, which is a very, very important portfolio. He's certainly going to help keep discipline around this place, Dr. Chen, so you can abdicate that responsibility quite nicely with regard to that. But Ms. Kubayi would be the person that you would chat to in instances where you have apologies to submit to the committee. If you have any queries related to general kind of admin stuff and so on of the committee, you would of course liaise with the secretary, but also if you need to escalate any kind of difficulties that you have, you would speak to Ms. Kubayi. What we will do is, once everybody's settled in, we will circulate contact details for Ms. Kubayi so that everybody has those as well. What I also would like, members, just as a housekeeping, I think we've now, sorry, let me just check, are there any other new members here today? Have they been told they're members of this committee yet? Okay, well, we're not sure, but I think, Ms. Kubayi, that's your first task, is just make sure that everybody knows where they need to be. I know that this reshuffling has not been very easy on people, but I take it as far as the opposition is concerned, that is sorted out. Members who I hear have been designated by your parties as permanent members to this committee. Is that correct? Okay, now that's great. If there are any problems and any changes, please, please be in touch with either myself or Ms. Kubayi in this regard. Okay. What I was going to just say by way of housekeeping is I tried, and I've asked the secretary of the committee to go onto the parliamentary website and just get a brief sort of CV of every member of this committee, because it becomes quite important, you'll see later when we go on delegations and so on, to introduce people ahead of time so that people that we go and visit as guests know who it is who composes the delegation ahead of time. So if members wouldn't mind in the next week or two, if you could submit a short synopsis of your CV to the committee secretary, just who you are, which province you come from, what you did prior, where your areas of speciality lies, and so on. That would help a great deal when we introduce you to different people and so on. But for the time being, and seeing as we're running a bit late, let me immediately hand over to the people from the South African Qualifications Authority, am I correct? Very welcome to you, gentlemen. I'm sure you're going to introduce yourself. I hope your presentation is how long? I think you better cut it down to 20 minutes, please, so that allows some time for interaction. Thank you. Please begin by introducing yourself, and very welcome to the session today.
And members of the Portfolio Committee, my name is Samuel Eintz. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the South African Qualifications Authority, and I have with us our Chief Finance Officer, Mr. Mark Albertain. The Portfolio Committee will be pleased to note that we've just finished our 2008-2009 audit, and for the 12th year running, SACWA has got a clean audit and unqualified audit, and Mark and his team have done an excellent job. Chairperson, to kick off, I'm going to quickly go through what is SACWA, the mission, objectives, the changes in our environment, the strategy, and then Mark will take us through the budget assumptions and the revenue, and then the various programs that underpin our expenditure. The South African Qualifications Authority is a statutory body. It's composed of 29 members at present. This figure will be reduced to 16 members when a new board is appointed. The present board was appointed by the Ministers of Education and Labour under the SACWA Act in 2007. That act is now repealed and we are working under the National Qualifications Framework Act, which has an implementation date of 1 June 2009. SACWA's mission is to oversee the further development and implementation of the National Qualifications Framework and to advance its objectives, which contribute to the full development of each learner and to the social and economic development of the nation at large. And for those who are not aware of the objectives of our National Qualifications Framework, it's about creating an integrated national framework for learning achievement to facilitate access, ability, progression within education, training, and career paths, to enhance the quality of education and training, to accelerate the reset of past unfair discrimination in education, training, and employment opportunities, and finally, to contribute to the full personal development of each learner, and again, the socioeconomic status of the nation at large. Now, in the extended review that took place on the NQF, these objectives, since the Act was promulgated, the SACWA Act was promulgated in 1995, these objectives have been not in dispute. They've been undisputed for everybody believes in these objectives. The question comes in is the implementation of how you achieve those objectives. Just to give an equity profile, we have a staff complement of 121, and again you will see there are 53 vacancies. Now again, this doesn't be cause for concern. It doesn't mean that we have 53 people not working. There are people in those posts. They are all temporary contracts, and the reason why those posts have not been filled is because in the moving to the NQF Act, two of the functions of SACWA moved to the QC, and as a result, there has to be some shift in terms of functions, and so what we've been doing is trying to keep a holding function while we have the transition. And in particular, for this committee, the transition to a quality council for trades and occupation, that's the one quality council that is not yet established, SACWA has to, in fact, to have a holding action in the interim. So what we've tried to do is to manage the human resources, to be proactive, and to make sure that when the time comes for the functions to go, that there is not a major retrenchment. And I can go into that in some detail if there are questions around that. In terms of meeting our NQF objectives, we have 8 directors with 13 operating units reporting to an executive office. And again, that is just for background information so that when we look at the program, you can see where the programs are being executed. The employment equity, again, we have a human resource consultative forum. They set the targets and monitor the achievements of those targets. And if there needs to be any deviation from agreed upon targets, there's a consultative process to take that forward. In terms of the changes to the environment, I've already pointed out the implementation of the new Act, which repeals the SACWA Act, and I will go into a fair amount of detail around the roles and responsibilities of the authority versus the Quality Council, and I'll talk to the transitional arrangements. What I've tried to do in these slides is to say what is SACWA's role, what is the Quality Council's role, and then to look at what is the mutual area. Because for the National Qualifications Framework to work, there has to be a system of collaboration between SACWA and the Quality Council. So SACWA will oversee the further development and implementation of the National Qualifications Framework, and we have to advance the objectives of access, quality, research and development. And the role of the council is to develop and manage the sub-framework. So we have a single integrated national qualification framework with three sub-frameworks, and at the head of each sub-framework there is a quality council. And again, it's incumbent on both SACWA and the three quality councils to establish that system of collaboration. In terms of level descriptors, these are part of what distinguishes the level of qualification. SACWA has developed the content of the level descriptors and reached agreement with the Quality Council. The Quality Council has to consider and agree the level descriptors, and it's a mutual responsibility to ensure that the level descriptors remain current and appropriate. To give you some flavor of what we're talking about, is our old national qualifications framework at 8 levels. We have now moved to 10 levels. The European qualifications framework, they have 8 levels. And so to give you an idea, PhDs are plugged at level 10, and your first degree are plugged in the 10-level framework at level 7. So again, you get a kind of sense of how the qualification of PET. And in some circles, that becomes a very contested terrain. And especially at level 5, where you have a plethora of diplomas and certificates. And that's a level just above the grade 12 of school. In terms of qualification, SACWA retains the function to register qualifications. But the standard setting, the standard generation function, that moves to the Quality Council. And so they develop the qualifications needed for each sector, and they recommend qualifications to SACWA for registration. The mutual function is we register those qualifications by looking at what the policy says, and there is a mutual responsibility to develop and implement policy and criteria for qualifications, for assessment, for the recognition of prior learning, and for credit accumulation and transfer. And that's an important function that goes across SACWA and the QC. And so the standard setting directorate of SACWA, that's part of the place where you have lots of people working on short-term contracts, because that function falls away. And in terms of how the system is developing, UMALUSI and the CHE, there are transitional arrangements where they will take control of that particular function. But for the Quality Council for Trades and Occupations, there is no such body yet. And so we have to hold that function until they're ready. In terms of quality assurance, the year is a big step. SACWA ceases to have any executive quality assurance function. That executive function moves to the Quality Council, and they ensure that quality assurance is undertaken in their sub-framework. And we still have the responsibility for coordinating across the sub-framework, and we are responsible for periodic impact studies of the National Qualification Framework. And again, that's important, because when we look at the impact of the NQF, we have to look at things like quality, and again, you'll see that becomes a mutual responsibility for us to ensure that there's integrity and credibility in the system, and that there's collaboration around the research and impact study. In terms of research, SACWA has to conduct regular studies on the impact of the NQF, and we have to maintain and further develop a collaborative research agenda relative to the development of the implementation of the NQF. I can just mention that when we started the NQF, 1995-96, there were about 5 countries in the world, and we were one of those 5. At the moment, there are some 150 countries around the world that are implementing NQF. And lots of people come to visit South Africa to find out about what we're doing, and we're very sought after to speak at international gatherings around the National Qualifications Framework. And there's at least been 7 PhD thesis on the NQF, from why it's failing to why it's working. And so I think there's a lot of that we are contributing as South Africans to this global phenomena of national qualification frameworks. The Quality Council will focus on research particular to their sub-framework, and again, we all have to commission research, publish findings, and collaborate on research agendas, and certainly between SACWA, OMALUSI, and the CHE, there's already a lot of collaboration in a whole number of areas. In terms of information management, we have a national learner records database, which is an individual learner records database for all learners from level 1 to 10 of the National Qualifications Framework. That's also a particularly important development. There are not many countries that have a database like that, and we are far advanced in populating that database, and it's already giving us some very good analysis of what's happening, for example, in public higher education, the uptake of qualifications in trades and occupations, for example. The Quality Councils all maintain a database or a relationship with a database, and they provide us with that information to SACWA. Again, the Quality Council for Trades and Occupations, they don't have a database as yet, so they're not established, and we gather the information directly from the 23 sector education and training authorities. Again, there's a need to ensure the integrity and validity of the data, and the need to analyze and report the findings. So this is quite a very important research tool. And working with GIPSA, they've come to have a look at the database, and as the new government moves into a more focused planning scenario, having reliable data is very important, and our National Learner Records database has been earmarked as an important database to feed into the human resource development strategy of South Africa. In terms of advocacy and marketing, SACWA has informed the public about the issue, and the Quality Council informs the public about the sub-framework, and here again I can talk to it, and I'm sure my colleagues from OMALUSI and the CHE will also attest this. There's been a collaborative movement around how we need to advocate the National Qualification Framework. It's not something that one body can do. We have to send out a consistent, coherent message. A lot of work has gone into that, and I want to thank my colleagues from the Quality Council for working with us in taking that forward. And once the minister gives us a launch date for this advocacy campaign, we see a lot of this in the various media and as well at the level of learners. I think it's important that the learners and the providers know what to expect of the new National Qualification Framework. A new development is that, and this is a new function that was given to SACWA, is that we have to develop and implement policy and criteria for recognizing professional bodies and for registering professional designations on the National Qualification Framework. Now, this is not to take away from any of the other statutory rights of professional bodies, but to recognize these bodies for the purposes of the National Qualification Framework Act, and that the professional designations which they protect and are custodians of, that those can be registered on the National Qualification Framework, and that's an important new function, and a lot of advanced work has already taken place, and over the next 6 months, we will be consulting and then asking the minister to sign off on policy in this area. The policy council will also work with the professional bodies in policy assurance and the development of qualifications. And of course, there is an imperative of all of us to consult with the professional bodies. In terms of international relationships, we have a responsibility to collaborate with our international counterparts concerning qualification frameworks, and we have a duty to inform the QCs and other stakeholders of the international best practice in terms of qualification framework. And again, the Quality Council similarly have a function, and obviously again the model of collaboration. There are some additional things that we have to do, one of which is to provide an evaluation and advisory service on foreign qualifications. That is a SACWA for someone wanting to work in South Africa. Their qualifications are evaluated by SACWA, and they are given an evaluation certificate which the Department of Home Affairs needs to issue a work permit. So we have been working in that particular area. And just to give you some kind of feeling for this, we get about between 120 and 150 applications a day. And there's been a lot of analysis about where are these individuals coming from to work in South Africa. And then there is an advisory function that each policy council has to advise the minister on their sub-framework, and of course SACWA has to advise the minister on NQF matters. The minister can also authorize us to perform any function consistent with our act that the minister has determined. So that in a nutshell is the new environment in which we are moving into. The transitional arrangement is very important, that there is coherent agreed planning and implementation. That certainly is happening at the level of SACWA for mobility and the CHE. The area that is there was certainty that the QCTO would be operational by 1 April 2010, but with the CETAs and the National Skills Fund moving, as we understand it, to the Ministry of Higher Education and Training, some of those timeframes might have to be revised, and I'm sure that we will be informed by the Minister appropriately once there's a proclamation as to which acts are falling under which minister. In terms of the financial arrangements and staffing implications, I think I've already given you a flavour of that, and I think we need to let Mark deal with the financial information. So there's a lot of things that go into these points in a whole lot of detail, but it picks up again the important trends. So Mark, if you can take the strategic plan and then take us through. Programs, plans, and
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thanks very much. Chair, I'm going to start off to go through some of the assumptions in terms of the budget as we set it up. And Madam Chair, I will highlight, in the interest of time, I will just highlight a couple of the most important ones. The rest of them are there for members to read. Chair, I think number one is that the budget is based on SACWA's new mandate in terms of the NQF Act, with an implementation date of 1 June. Chair, in personnel costs will be adjusted for inflation at 7%, and we have also built in performance and broadband and level adjustments for all staff of all levels. Chair, then we look at, in terms of income, will be around 6% in terms of our forecast, except for, as we have said, the foreign qualifications, evaluation and advisory services, which will plateau in 2010, and then it will decline by 15% after that. Chair, then the inflation in costs will be 9%, with SACRA having to absorb any high inflation by using our resources more effectively and efficiently to still achieve our operational goals. Then, Chair, on the next slide, the authorised products and services of the National Learners Records Database. We will continue to generate more income as more research and analysis is done in terms of the database. Funding from government will be at least 39.1 million. Then, Chair, we will also seek extra funding for clearly defined and discrete projects that a lot of those will go into in terms of research, also international liaison projects. Chair, then you will see note number 13 that in light of the new NQF Act, we have reduced our staff numbers by 23 members, and that was mainly due to the standard setting and the quality assurance functions that will be moving to the quality councils. Then there were extra positions created in terms of the National Learners Records Database, which means that our overall decrease in permanent staff to 109 staff members. Chair, then, looking at the numbers, you will see that our total revenue that we estimate for the 9-10 year is 63.2 million, of which government funding is 39 million. The other revenue, in terms of non-tax revenue, the 20 million, the vast majority of 16.5 million of that comes from the services that we render in terms of the evaluation of the foreign qualifications. The other is project revenue and other interest and sundry revenue that we do generate. In terms of the expenditure side, you'll see that as we've highlighted the compensation for employees, the goods and services and transfer payments that we do receive. You'll see that the compensation of employees does comprise the bulk of the expenditure in terms of the budget. There, the total 61.8 million. The remaining balance, if we go to the next slide, Chairs, in terms of our capital expenditure on property, plant, and equipment, in terms of computer infrastructure expenditure, hardware and software, and also in terms of furniture and equipment. Chair, then to outline our, in terms of the programs that we do have, there's five programs there, of which number three, we have in terms of the new NQF Act, now included as one program under program two, which is standard setting and quality assurance, that in the interim, while the transition is taking place, we will still continue to perform. So, Chair, those are just the numbers, the total budget 63 as it's broken down. What I will do is quickly talk to the various different programs and just highlight what are the main plans under each of them. Program one is administration and support, and that covers activities of the executive office, as well as finance and administration, the human resources, information and information technology, strategic support, which is a lot of the advocacy for the NQF, and then also the research. In terms of that, we plan to partner major stakeholders to ensure systematic coordination, coherence, and resource alignment to the benefit of learners in line with the national HRD strategy. And I know Samuel has actually spoken to a lot of this in the first part of the presentation. We'll also advise and inform policymakers on all the matters relating to the NQF. We will, as we have said, maintain an effective public NQF communication and advocacy strategy. We'll collaborate with SACRA's international counterparts, and we will ensure the aligned development of the human, financial, and infrastructural resources to support the achievement of the organization's objectives. And lastly, on administration and support, just advise and inform policymakers, which we have discussed, and we have discussed in terms of the research that we will undertake. In terms of program number two, standard setting and quality assurance, we'll continue to provide leadership and professional expertise to ensure that high-quality, nationally relevant, and internationally comparable unit standards and qualifications that articulate across the sub-frameworks are registered on the NQF. In terms of the standard setting as well, we ensure the quality assurance here will support the Department of Labor in implementing the Amended Skills Development Act in establishing a quality assurance body. Then Chair, program number 4 is National Learners Records Database. We will continue to ensure the information on the NLRD is of acceptable quality and that previously inaccessible data is now available. And then Chair, lastly, program number 5 is in terms of the evaluation of the foreign qualifications. We'll continue to maintain and develop the role of SACWA's Directorate of Foreign Qualifications Evaluation Advisory Services as a national recognition information centre for foreign and domestic learning and qualifications. Thanks very much.
Do you want to switch back on? Thank you. So clearly, you know, in the short time that we have available, it's not possible for us to do justice to the work that you do and so on. And what we will do, hopefully, either both committees jointly or certainly in the higher education, sometime will be spent just looking at each of the statutory bodies, and this applies to all of you. We will hopefully take a day and start. Where are your offices?
Pretoria.
Okay. It may be that we may have to come up there because of you coming up here. But we will obviously in the next term be in touch with you. And of course, we'll see you in August again. So hopefully before August, we will spend some time talking about what you do and how you do it. And clearly, you're also in a bit of a flux yourself. Okay, so members, floor is open. Questions? I've got Mr. Boinamo. I've got Mr. Lajeto. I've got Ms. Vukuza, I've got Ms. Moshwana, I've got Dr. James, Ms. Kubayi, in that order, and then I'll take a second round, right?
Thank you, Chair. You have the staff complement of 121, and you have 88 staff members. What prevents you from filling all the posts that you actually require? Question number 2, since the establishment of SACWA, how many qualifications have been registered by SACWA, and can you break qualifications according to various fields? How well is the public informed about the staff framework? Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you. That's 3 questions. Next. Mr. Lachita.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, you are talking about we need to prioritize freedom of posts. When are you going to fill this 32 post? My last question is, you're talking about staff reduction of 23. What is that? Where do you take these people? What is your alternative to taking the people out of the city when we want to have unemployment by 2040?
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I think I'm covered. I just wanted to understand the whole capacity that the NGO is running.
Who did I have first? Moshwana. Put your mic up.
The wrong one. Thank you, Chairperson. I'm also covered because I was concerned about reduction. And you see, the number is going down, and we're talking of employment here in Parliament. But then, the other one that I would like to talk to is. I think it's about the function that they perform to determine the qualifications, amongst others, to evaluate the evaluate those coming from outside, if I heard him correctly. Now I'm checking if if these people go to NGOs, because there are a lot of schools out there that are not necessarily within the framework of South Africa. They are in South Africa. I think I saw the and monitor them. How do you go and check those qualifications? Because it's like people will come with qualifications that you don't know what they mean. To give you an example, from India, and they teach in this course, and who monitors that? Thank you.
If I can just compliment you on the work that you do, having some familiarity with that. So thank you very much for the service to the nation. My question's about whether you lead or whether you follow when it comes to providing the qualifications framework around the knowledge required for the 21st century. And the mission of the Education Department is to provide that knowledge. Now, that begs the question of what is going to happen in the 21st century for which that knowledge is required, such as climate change issues and so on and so forth. But it's really to ask the question about whether you follow what it is that the education authorities themselves specify, or whether you lead, or whether you do both, or whether there's an engagement, constant conversation about what qualifications ought to be abandoned and what new ones need to be introduced. There's discussion, for example, about the need to go back to the earlier system of teacher training and nursing education and agricultural extension education and so on.
Goodbye.
Thanks, Chair. I think also I need to follow on what Dr. Smith has said, that comment to SAQA on the West Africa too. I'm glad to see that there is going to be an initiative on public information, because I think there is a lot of work that needs to go out in informing the public on in terms of what SAQA does. My first question is based on your employment equity profile. I think as a comment firstly to say that it should be helpful to get an overview. When you have Africans, colored, Indian, white, in which level as per categories of employment it should affect, because it is an indication typical of your profile, especially as required as well by legislation. But again, in terms of your employees with disability, what are your level of targets? What have you set in your employment equity plan as targets? And what is it? Where are you versus that? Against that target. The other issue that I want to speak on is on recognition of prior learning, RPL. I see that you have highlighted that you're going to have to put some effort in making sure that raise the profile of RPL. What is it specifically that you'd be doing to raise this profile that you have not done before to change this? And why are you saying that you want to raise the profile in terms of RPL? And then the last issue for me, on summary, unfortunately my slides don't have pages. I'm just going to speak, I think it's part of your strategy. SAQA is much stronger now than in 2008. That's the statement that you've made. And perhaps maybe one would want to understand in which, what do you mean by that? What is it that is different compared to previous years that has made SAQA more stronger? Is it the change of the legislation that sort of gave you the strength, or has there been any form of changes within the institution itself? Thanks, Chair.
Let me answer those. Let me just check. I think Mr. Makubela has some questions as well. Do you want to bring those now so that what we do is we take all of the questions and then we can move on?
Okay, thanks, Sean. That's these questions. One, there are these fly-by-night institutions. Who deals with that basically if they emerge or mushroom at whatever level? Often students are taken for a ride and they go away with murder. You don't get any sense of them being dealt with and so on and so on. I think perhaps it's understood. I may not need to elaborate on that. The second one, Yes, you're talking inflation and that may be affected in terms of the budget, but I don't get it whether there are budgetary constraints. I worry if there's any problem or you think you're fine, you'll handle everything that you're supposed to do within the budget that you've got. The last one, in terms of this qualification, government has come up with a lot of new job titles, most of which, even in institutions of higher learning, have not been provided for. Not very clear what qualification is required. And people with various qualifications might have served in such jobs and even failed, and it's not clear what they do need, and the public out there may be worried. Or the institutions of higher learning as well, they're working out models or courses to try and take care of that. While there are these people who are practitioners already in the field without clear indication of what qualifications needed to be there. I'm checking with you to what extent are you able to catch up with time, moving at a pace that is required. People can give examples and so on. But I'm just saying there are many of such instances wherein you don't even come into the picture.
Not elaborate, just...
Okay. Fine, I think I can just
thank you. I think my question is probably along the same lines. Is the budget adequate in terms of the needs and what is the real challenge that's going to be the year's challenge in terms of what you've experienced?
All my years in Parliament, I have yet to meet an institution that has satisfied
this. But we need to know what you really are concerned about at this moment in terms of this budget.
Thank you, Chairperson. I would like to note with appreciation the objective with regard to learning achievements, which is one of the main objectives. And then also as part of the strategy, FAQA said that learners must be the beneficiaries of, amongst others. So my question is, and I would like to use a specific example with regard to grade R. In my opinion, the grade R situation is a bit ad hoc. And this now relates to my colleague's question earlier. Are you pointing to the education department, maybe, the situation, that it is a bit ad hoc and maybe job creation instead of quality? In grade R is the objective. We should remind us all we cannot put our learners at risk to have job creation instead of looking at the quality education. I think learning achievements then will be very important and we cannot mess that up. Thank you.
So you've got a bunch of very attentive students who are asking you very important questions, except on the issue of the vacancies. Nobody seems to have listened to what you said about that, so maybe you should start with that one.
Chair, I think we share the Honourable Member's concern about shedding jobs. And the move from the SACWA Act to the NQF Act, if it is properly coordinated, should not, in fact, leave anybody without a job. The difficulty that in the migration from the one act to the other under the transitional arrangement, it was envisaged that because most of the work that needed to be done happens in the Quality Council for Trades and Occupations, there would be a transfer of function plus staff too, and there were lots of discussion, and myself and our chairperson, Professor Shirley Walters, has met with senior officials at the Education Department as well as the Department of Labour to get a memorandum of understanding to do this, and this has been over a period of almost 2 years. And in the absence of achieving that arrangement with the Department of Labor, we've had to then look at what is the next best thing. And when people ask about how did these numbers go down and why are we in a better position in 2008, is that there was a lot of uncertainty. And when there's uncertainty, people can get other jobs, migrate. And what we did was, instead of going to fill that post with another person that could be stuck, we then appointed a contract person for a set period, explaining to the person the difficulties, and that's the way we've managed it. So what gave rise to the uncertainty was an NQF review process, which started in 2001 and only concluded at the end of 2007. And then you have the NQF Act, and so slowly stability is coming back and is a way forward. And once we know exactly how things are going to pan out in the Ministry for Higher Education and Training, with CETAs of the NSF coming, I think there will be a lot more certainty as to how this can go forward. So I think, first of all, that it's been dealt with in a very sensitive way, and in fact, there's nobody in SACWA that is permanent that is going to lose their job, and it looks like as this transition is going to take another year and a bit, that the people in that present job will remain and hopefully be absorbed into the structure when the jobs are advertised. So I think we're managing that position very carefully. The question about how are people informed around these issues, again, I think SACWA and the QC have gone quite far to be able to explain, as I did earlier, who's doing what, how these things are happening. There is a help desk that is presently being established that will be able to deal with the public's questions around this. There are one or two negotiations that need to happen with the new Department of Higher Education and Training, and to get a date when the minister will launch the new advocacy campaign. And, of course, then we will make sure that there's enough information there so that everybody can find out exactly what is happening. In terms of the evaluation of non-government organization qualifications, our Directorate for Foreign Qualifications Evaluation has got an extensive database of qualifications from most countries. We know, for example, whether the country recognizes those qualifications, and we also know where, for example, there are qualifications that are credible but not nationally recognized. And there is a way that those qualifications can be evaluated, and if there is a real doubt about the quality of that, in some cases, universities have been able for access to another learning program to arrange for some kind of advanced standing to be given. So I think there's a number of ways in which that particular issue is dealt with. In terms of the question about qualifications, how many are registered, I'm going to give you approximate figures, Mr. Boinama, but what I will do is I will make sure that you get a breakdown. There are approximately about 10,000 qualifications registered on the National Qualifications Framework. About 7,000 of those are higher education qualifications, and the others are a combination of qualifications from level 1 to level 5. So we can certainly get you the detailed breakdown of that, and I'll make sure that happens. In terms of the staffing and the equity about the equity profile across various categories within the organization, we do have that. We do report on that to our board, and again, I can make that available. It goes from the admin clerks right up to the chief executive officer. So I can do that. Disability target is 4%, and the latest figure that I have in my head was 2%. We had learners, then it goes up to a little bit, and then the learner leaves, and then it goes down again. But at the moment, we are not at the 4%. In terms of the question from Dr. James, do we lead or do we follow? I think that's a very important question. To some extent, I would say we do both. In terms of qualifications that are already registered, they have a shelf life of 3 years, after which they have to be reviewed. There's a process for reviewing it, and provided the stakeholders who use the qualifications are serious about it, they then can change their qualification. So that's important. Where WETAC leads is we do two important things. We insist that qualifications, in terms of the Act, they have to be internationally comparable. So before a qualification gets re-registered or a new qualification comes on board, they have to show us that there has been an international comparability study done. And that's quite important. And then lastly, in a thing called the critical cross-field education and training outcomes, these are the things like systems thinking, problem solving, research skills, communication. In terms of that, SACWA conducted the study to ensure that those particularly transferable attributes are embedded across the qualification. So that's the way I think in which we are leading, but the system depends also on the stakeholders for taking charge, and that's where professional bodies, the universities, play a very important role. In terms of why we're much stronger, I think SACWA has been, in many ways, a model statutory body. I've mentioned the unqualified audit. I've been the chief executive since it started, and we have a core staff that has continued to work with us, so there's stability in the organization. And I think there's a commitment to work in a collaborative way. And what we have begun to understand is that the real genius of an NQF is not in all the frameworks and all the bureaucratic things that we have to do, but it's a framework for collaboration, for coordination, and communication across education, training, and work. And that's the important understanding that we've come to. And there's a lot of international literature that supports that view. It's a framework for communication, collaboration, and coordination. And I think if we can succeed in implementing our N2F in a coherent way and with the collaboration and the clear communication, I think we can be a world leader. The issue about job titles, I think that job titles is and how those relate to qualifications is incredibly important. It's basically a human resource management problem. And I think here the Department of Labor has given the country something very valuable. They have developed the organizational framework of occupation. And it's a kind of international classification system. And they've taken that one step further. And so it's possible to get a more coherent approach to how occupations are classified. And that will certainly help with having the qualifications that match it. SACWA is also working very closely with PALAMA, the old SAMDI, to make sure that civil servants in particular have the necessary learning that will underpin their work. The question about grade R is a very important one from Mr. Smile, and there we have, unfortunately, grade R, the framework from level 1 to 10, the lower levels of schooling, plus grade R, falls outside the ambit of the National Qualifications Framework. But grade R remains an important, early childhood development is incredibly important. And where SACWA has again led is to work with the Department of Education to develop the qualifications for early childhood development workers. Level 1 is at the end of grade 7. Okay, grade 8. And the qualification is in fact given at the end of grade 9. So the end of grade 9 would in fact be in QF level 1. So that's important. So, but again, it's not to say we're not interested in that because it's not on the framework. We believe the teachers we teach in there are there, and we've done work for that. And there is a research report on how new qualifications in an area that was underdeveloped has in fact impacted on the system. And I think the point you make, Mr. Smiles, about this is not about just employment for people to keep children busy. It's about quality learning in that in environment. I left the best question for last, which is the question about the budget. Of course, if we look at what we were planning, we certainly can do more, and we can accelerate certain things if there is more money. But what we've tried always to do, and the arrangement that we have with the Department of Education, is we submit a budget that we have funds that have been clearly identified for it, and then what we do is if there are areas of work that we believe is very important, we go out and try and get that from donors. We've also been successful in the past of getting money from the sector education and training authorities, as well as from the National Skills Fund. And then we use that money to do that. And again, it's not just get the money and go and do it. We then take it through a budgetary process. The minister approves our budget for the new money that we by means of a revised budget, and then we proceed along that particular path. And in the past, the education department has also been able, not the past year, but years before, when there's some savings elsewhere, then we do get an extra million or two which we can utilize for some of the areas that are undeveloped. In fact, what we do with the department is to give them three budgets. Scenario one, that's what we really like to do. Okay.
Chair, I think Samuel has addressed that, and that's what...
Yes, Chair, if I could just briefly say that we have three scenarios. And so the last scenario, scenario three, is where we balance the budget to meet the money. So if we want to extend, the plans are not things that we just think about. They're already plans on the table that we can, in fact, do. But in terms of delivering the main service, the budget that we currently have, provided there are no thoughts of reducing that budget, we will be able to manage.
What's the one question on fly-by-night that you...
Oh, yes, yeah, sorry. Yeah. Chair, I think the fly-by-night situation, there are two ways that we deal with it. SACWA and the QCs deal with the fly-by-night by making learners aware and their parents aware of what they need to do to get a institution that is credible, that is registered and accredited. The closing down of those institutions, as I understand it, is the Department of Education responsibility. they are the registering, they register the institutions, and so the closing down of those institutions would have to take place by means of the department doing it. I don't think SACWA or one of the statutory bodies is able to do that.
When they register, do they not consult with you at all?
No. When we're talking about fly-by-nights, we are talking about people who are unregistered and not accredited. So what we do is we make sure that people know, and if they go to the website, if they phone in, we can certainly tell them who is accredited and registered and who is not. But very often, these fly-by-nights, and we have looked at how we can try and stop them more effectively. But what basically happens is people are not able, because of their grades or whatever, to get into institutions. And parents are so desperate. So somebody comes along then and says, we are nursing college or we are that, and people then register.
I think we understand that problem. The problem that we have is that it's only much later, once people have been burned, that, you know, we tend to close them down. So what we're trying to establish is, and maybe you want to put your heads together with the department and others, to find out if there's not a mechanism earlier on that one can perhaps either legislate or regulate. That perhaps this happens in other countries. I mean, what do they do when they face with the situation? Can schools that are unregistered even get a lease from someone? Let's have a further discussion on that at a later stage. But let me thank you, Mr. Benami. Is there anything you wanted to add on this issue of the budget? Okay. Thank you very much.
We have to move, Mr. Boynabo.
Yes, but my question is for me.
Which one?
On what extent the public is informed about...
They did answer it. They did answer it, yeah.
Thank you. We are now moving on to which one? Umalusi. Who is here from Umalusi? Please take up your seats here. Very welcome to you. Please begin whenever you're ready by introducing yourself and going straight into your presentation.
Thank you very much, Mme Chogan, Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee for Basic Education. Honorable members of the Portfolio Committee, let me appreciate this opportunity given to Umalusi to come and do this presentation to this Honorable Committee. Umalusi is the Quality Council for Further Education and Training. Let me indicate that with me here, I am with the Chief Operating Officer, Mayor Eugenie Rabe, and I'm also with the CFO, Chief Financial Officer, Mr. Jeremy Thomas. It was the wish of the Chairperson of the Council to be here with us. The presentation is going to be focusing on the Umalusi mandate from the time Umalusi started in 2001, as mandated by the Gensetqua Act, General and Further Education and Training Quality Assurance Act. And it is also going to focus on the amendments of the same act and how we're operating in the transitional arrangement for 2009. I'm just going to rattle through the mission, vision, and goals, and quickly also look at the key results area. And the colleagues will share the 2009-10 plans and budgets. And I'll give you the conclusion in terms of the challenges. Chairperson, the Umalusi mandate, according to the Gensetqua Act of 2001, is to ensure quality enhancement in the general and further education and training band. That is your grade 1 to 12, and your FET colleges programs. We're also looking, according to that mandate of 2001, at developing a quality assurance framework for the same band of the NQF. We're looking at monitoring qualifications and standards. We're looking at quality assuring assessment at the exit point, and the chief operating officer is going to get into the details of those. We're looking here at the external moderation of question papers, monitoring of examinations, monitoring of marking, the standardization process. We are also looking at the certification of learner achievement, those papers that the learners carry out of the system, which is proof that they have gone through a particular program. UMADUSI, according to the 2001 mandate, also look at the accreditation of pilot providers. All the independent schools, according to the South African Schools Act, UMADUSI accredits them after they would have been registered by the Department of Education. We will monitor and report to the National Department of Education on the provincial departments of education, with specific reference to all the areas of operation and their examinations and assessment. That's according to the 2001 mandate. The Act also intends to regulate the relationship between the National Department of Education, the South African Qualifications Authority, that is just a direct presentation here, and other PTQA bodies, the providers and the council. The minister was supposed to issue regulations in that regard to manage our relationship. The mandate was amended according to the Kentesqua Act as amended 2009, and this changed UMADUSI from being a quality assurance body to a quality council. And as a mandate, we had to develop and manage a sub-framework of qualifications for general and further education and training framework. And we also developed and quality assure qualifications and curriculum. All the qualifications in our band have to be quality assured by UMADUSI, and the curriculum and the qualification. And we have to quality assure assessment only at exit point. That means internal assessment in grade 1, grade 2, grade 3, where there are no exit points for learners who want to leave school for, according to the NQF, we don't quality assure those. And like I said in the previous slide, that would include the external moderation of question papers, monitoring of examinations, monitoring of marking, and the standardization. We also have to certificate learner achievement, so that the paper that the learner ultimately carries after completing a qualification at the exit point will be issued by UMADUSI after having quality assured the qualification. According to the 2009 mandate, the quality assurance of provision and accreditation of private providers, as in the previous mandate, still remains. We also conduct research related to the sub-framework. This is a new mandate. We do not have this mandate according to the 2001 Kentesqua Act. We also have a mandate to advise the minister. We advise the minister on all areas of quality assurance in our band. Chairperson, in the interest of time, I'm not going to talk to the vision and mission, as it talks in the main to the mandate that we have. So I'm not going to talk to the mission and vision, and I'm also not going to talk to the goals. I'm instead going to focus on the seven key result areas. The first one being improving and maintaining the system for quality assuring assessment for certification. We have to continuously improve that system and maintain it so as to make sure that what we certificate has been properly quality assured. Establishing and implementing a system of evaluation and accrediting private providers so that for the private providers to operate, like I said initially, they have to register with the Department of Education, and then we evaluate and accredit the quality of curriculum that they offer. establishing and maintaining a system to certify and quality assure qualifications and curricula. We need to do also research, diagnose, and report on quality in general and further education and training, supported by statistical analysis. We need to develop and maintain management support structures in government, ensure that our IT is working, and we have to continuously improve our IT system to be compatible with the IT system that is used by the different examination bodies. We also have to ensure that financing and resources and administrative support does exist and it is continuously maintained and improved. I need to, just before I hand over to the colleagues, comment about the transitional arrangement with the new NQF Act and with the new GenSetCo Act as amended, and indicate that there is a task team that is led by the Department of Education where we sit with SAQUA and all the other quality councils to look at the transitional measures as we move from being a quality assurance body to a quality council. Those things have to be taken care of in a seamless manner, and that calls for coherent planning. Hence, we meet in that way. For instance, there are certain functions that are going to take from SAQUA, like standard setting. And we look at how those are going to move so that the country does not suffer. We don't have a period where we say there's nobody doing the function, so that the transition is seamless. And that is going on very well. I'm going to hand over to the colleague, the Chief Operating Officer, to rattle through the presentation. Thank you, sir.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm just going to speak very, very briefly to Umalusi's operations and what we plan for the next year. I think possibly, well, central to Umalusi's whole mandate is the notion that it should issue credible certificates for the qualifications that it quality assures. And so in taking over the standard setting function from South African Qualifications Authority, we look at our four areas. Firstly, setting standards through the quality assurance assessment, then setting standards through looking at the provision and the quality of provision in private provision, looking at the quality assurance at qualifications, the standard of the curriculum, and then having done those three things, we feel that we can issue a credible certificate. So for us, standard setting is more complex than just developing a qualification. It is supported by by those three legs. Umalusi's longest and most established quality assurance function is the quality assurance assessment. We quality assure 11 examinations in a year. Those are all national examinations related to the following qualifications and schooling. We quality assure the National Senior Certificate, which was written for the first time in 2008. We also quality assure the Senior Certificate, which is being phased out, but which continues to be written until 2011. In terms of FET colleges, we quality assure the National Technical Certificates N3, as well as the National Certificate Vocational, which is a new qualification phased in 2007, and the NQF4 being written now for the first time in 2009. Further, we quality assure in the area of adult education the GETC, General Education and Training Certificate for adults. Those are all the certificates we issue and the examinations that are conducted and quality assured through Umalusi. And Mr. Nakhamiti has already really covered what those processes are. It's a moderation, monitoring, and standardization processes that take place in terms of all of those examinations. So that is really, in a nutshell, what happens in quality assurance assessment. In terms of the evaluation and accreditation of private providers, Umalusi has been working in that area since 2003. We quality assure private provision or accredited providers, if you like, independent schools, private FET colleges, which would be all your commercial sort of vocationally oriented colleges, and adult education providers. That is a process that runs alongside the registration process with the state. The two are separate processes, but complementary. We work quite closely with provincial departments of education and the national department in terms of those. Just to give you some sort of sense of the numbers that we have on our books right now, in terms of independent schools, we have about 1,500 independent schools. Of course, there are many more that are not on our books, and that raises the whole issue around the Flabanat thing again. In terms of colleges, there's about 450 on our books. These are large national colleges predominantly. And then in terms of adult education, we have about 120 providers. They offer mainly an industry, though. They don't really offer, outcomes. They're not institutions. They're more consultancy kind of things. Our actual processes there are around accreditation, around we do site visits, we monitor them annually, and we report on them annually in terms of that. And, of course, stakeholder relationships are very important. So we have provider forums and conferences and so on to share best practice in terms of provision. In terms of further, in terms of evaluation and accreditation, we also accredit independent assessment bodies, like the IEB, and just Independent Examinations Board, examines the matric as an alternative matric, and also the Onafhanklike Afrikaanse Examinaraad, which also examines the matric. Currently, there's only those two that we've accredited, but there are others knocking on the door. We're very careful around that, though. We just don't take it, just anybody. In terms of qualifications, curriculum, and certification, this is really where the new mandate starts to impact. Previously, we were only required to monitor the standards. Now we are, in fact, required to develop those standards, develop the standards. So our transitional arrangements start to knock into this particular unit here in this area of work. We have developed a qualification sub-framework. It is with the Department of Education currently in relation. And we are working on other internal policies and obviously working with SACWA around take and transfer of certain things and also how we would set about registering qualifications, establishing those processes between us. Umalusi certifies the qualifications that I've already listed. It's a very big income stream for Umalusi. A lot of our income comes from here. We issue more than 700,000 certificates annually, just to give you an idea of the system, and obviously we continue to plan for that. Our main budgetary areas this year would be around developing new certification systems for new qualifications, as in the case of the NCV, and improving the one for the NSC. Another income stream is the verification process. Umalusi verifies the authenticity of matric certificates for employers and others, and that is also quite a strong income stream for Umalusi. And then finally, the statistical information and research. This particular area, we are developing a quality indicator report, which we hope to submit by the end of this financial year. And our research that supports our professional work is looking particularly at this time at standards in national senior certificate curriculum and past exam papers, as well as in the NCV looking at curriculum. We are also currently evaluating, as part of this year's planning, the GET. Foundation phase curriculum and comparing it with the Kenyan, Singaporean, and Canadian curriculum in that area. Further, we are employed, we're involved in a project with ESA around equivalent setting for foreign qualifications. Coming in, say, for instance, an example would be the Cambridge trick, for instance. And then we're looking at best practice in terms of practical work that would feed into the vocational colleges. Those are our sort of research projects. I'll hand over now to the CFO to speak about the budgetary issue.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson and members. I will deal with the fifth key result area, which is the management support structures, which speaks to the Office of the Chief Executive Officer, managed by the CFO, COO, and the CEO. And our plan for 2009 and 10 is to ensure that the organizational planning and all its reports and policies are vetted by the council, as well as that the networking with stakeholders has taken place for the year. We're looking at an internal and external communication plan and ensure that Umalusi's corporate identity is strengthened for the year, and that organizational governance is maintained through its annual calendar cycle. In terms of the Corporate Services Division for Information Technology, the purpose is to ensure that IT systems are maintained and established and improved, and one of the main indicators there is the gap analysis to be done on the management information system, which seems to be an ever-increasing and growing animal for the organization as we add new and more changes to the system. Maintaining our website as well as developing those systems to accredit new assessment bodies. We have a certification program which validates all certification data that comes in from all provinces before we certificate, and it's important for us to ensure that that certification system is always maintained and up to date. Ensuring that the organization is adequately equipped with the hardware and software, as well as the utilization of all the resources in terms of IT, knowing that the IT computer components are always increasing in price, and we have to kind of manage that effectively. In terms of finance and administration, the main outcome is the finance and accounting systems to be maintained and improved, internal controls, risk management, internal and external audits are done, and we are also pleased to note that we have not had a qualified audit in the past 7 years of operation, as well as this financial year, we will not have a qualified audit. As well as ensuring that we collect all our debt. We're in an unfortunate position where provinces pay for services rendered for certification, and therefore it means we have to invoice them on a regular basis, and our target is 90% of debt to be collected, and we've been able to achieve that every financial year. In terms of payments for goods and services, that's normally on time. We invest our surplus funds with the Corporation for Public Deposits, with the Reserve Bank, in line with our investment policy. And at this point in time, we have about 24 million in reserves with the CPD. The management of our fixed assets is an annual occasion where we need to register and label those assets. And of course, ensuring that our building is tight and secure. We have a CapEx expenditure of about 2 million for this year for improvements to the security system, as well as changing some of the units to have more open plan kind of setup to accommodate more staff. In terms of our HR management and development component, we need to ensure that our human resources are correctly managed in terms of the HR policies in line with the Labor Relations Act. And at this point in time, I think Umalusi has about 75 staff members and about 77 posts. And the equity profile is about 60%. I think it's 60% female, 40% male. Okay, good. Good, out of that. Thanks. In terms of staff development, it's important for us to ensure that our staff competencies are improved during the year, as well as submitting all our reports to the ETDP CETA, and ensure that our general services of telephone cleaning and registry is maintained. If we look at our income budget for 2009, you will note that in terms of income, we're planning to collect accreditation fees. Those are the fees that private providers would pay for accreditation. Certification fees, 18.9 million. Our departmental grant is 16.4 million for the year. Reserve funds, 10.4 million. So of our reserves of 24 million, we will be utilizing 10 million to prop up our budget for this financial year. Verification fees, planning to collect 4 million. So we have a budget of 53.8. as approved by the minister in March of this year. In terms of expenditure, you will note the various units and divisions of work where money will be spent, quality assurance of assessment, etc., totaling 53.8 million. If we go to the next slide, in terms of the three-year budget forecast, this financial year we saw a 22% increase in our budgetary requirements. And for 2010, we're looking at an increase of 29% and to plateau down to 13% by 2011. And one of the main reasons for that is that we will be looking at increasing our sample sizes that we use for quality assurance of assessment, and therefore we forecast that increase for 2010. If we then look at our total income and budget since Umalusi's inception, section, you will kindly note that the first time Umalusi got a grant was in 2002/3, which was 1.5 million, which was about 11% of the total income for that year. We were fortunate in that that grant percentage gradually increased to, in 2004/5, 55%, but then it dropped again, down to 27%. And I think what we're trying to show here is the fact that for 2009/10, our grant is 31% of our total budget, and for 2010/11, it goes down to 25%. And we are making appeals to the department, of course, through the necessary channels for an increase in our budgetary allocation based on the very low baseline allocation which was allotted to Umalusi in 2002/3. The next slide, therefore, shows the, in terms of the DOE grant for this financial year, 2009/10, and the fact that Umalusi is going to be utilizing 19% of its budget will be funded from its own reserve fund. In 2010, the baseline allocation is 17.3 million, and there is a shortfall in the budget of 15.7 million. And Umalusi is in discussion with the Department of Education to see, to find ways to make up that shortfall. So Umalusi is likely requesting an increase of the percentage grant from 25% to 47% of its budget for 2010/11, and naturally that spills over into 2011/12. In terms of external audit comments that we received at the external audit that took place now a few weeks ago, the audit matters, matters that could affect the audit opinion, there were none. We had a few debtors with credit balances, and where we had offset that against our total debtors book, we were asked to refrain from doing that, and we will now investigate some of those debtors with credit balances and allocate it correctly. In terms of our provision for impairment of debtors, there is outstanding debt, of course, but fortunately it is collectible debt, as most of our clients are government departments and FET institutions. Therefore, there was a minimal provision made. The difference between the general ledger and the VIP payroll system, there was a 3,500 discrepancy, and we are going to look at an electronic interface that will remove that particular problem. And then we agreed that the useful lives of our assets would be reviewed on an annual basis. Thank you, Chair. Over to the CEO.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. As we conclude, I would like to briefly focus on the challenges of Umalusi. The challenges of Umalusi as an organization, I'll be very brief. Is the financial sustainability of the organization through increased funding by the DOE and National Treasury. We're looking at the at possible funding model, as indicated by the CFO, and we are also in the process of negotiating with National Treasury and the DOE on the move from the certification fee to the quality assurance levy. Maybe I need to just explain the difference here. The difference is currently we're charging a certification fee, and that will depend on the number of candidates that pass. If 60% of the candidates pass, it means we are only going to get 60% levy from the provinces. As opposed to quality assurance levy, where we are saying to the DOE, because we have quality assured the whole examination, as I illustrated with the external modulation of the papers, the monitoring of the marking and so forth and so on, the standardization, would want to charge a levy for all the candidates who sit for an examination. And that would also obviate the problem of collecting debt from the province. So we quality assure the whole qualification, therefore, all the learners that participate in the examination that we quality assure must pay a levy. Because of our increased mandate, according to the new Kentetkwa Act as amended, our budget is a serious challenge. Our mandate has increased, and the budget has not increased congruently We need to do the finalization of some associating function from SAPA to Manufi, and also look with SAPA and the DOE on the required resources. We're also looking at the ongoing mapping and integration of all organizational processes to culminate in an effective risk management strategy, including knowledge management, management information system, record system, and retention strategy of our staff. And because we're a small organization, we don't want to lose staff. Chairperson, I want to thank the Honorable Committee and yourself for the opportunity to present Umalu here. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Rakumitsi. I'm sorry to have rushed you, and again, the same applies to your organization. We will try and spend some time, hopefully over a whole day, with you to try and get to some of the challenges in moving forward and so on. And I know that members are going to flood you with questions, and we don't have too much of time. So what I want to do from the chair is to pose some general questions, which you'll note, and then I'll open up for members. If I haven't covered you, then you ask a question, okay? Now, let me first pose a question. Then you'll know whether I covered you. Otherwise, you won't know whether I covered you. Okay. As I understand it, there's this transition between yourself and SAQUA and so on. I think what you're going to need to do is, in a very specific way, give us a report that speaks very clearly and very simply to exactly what functions you're hoping to take over, that they're currently doing, and where those overlaps are currently. Okay? So that we understand, even before we engage with you on that one-day session that I'm promising, what those functions are and how they... If you want to answer some of those things very broadly now, you can do so. But give us a written report in that regard so that we have it in front of us and we can assess what is happening. And of course, this difference between you now being a quality council as opposed to what you were previously, all of that will fit into that report. As I understand it, you say quality enhancement of grade 1 to 12 and FEP. I imagine that's now also an assessment, a quality assessment. Maybe you want to give us a broad sense of where you think we are standing as a country. In other words, are you completely satisfied with the quality of education, particularly in our schools at this stage? And where do we stand in your assessment? I know it's early days and so on, but where do we stand from your perspective so that we can engage a little bit on that? On this issue of the fly-by-nights, as I understand it, there's a registration process by the Department of Education which then kicks in a process of accreditation from your side. So really it's only if an institution registers. And now we're talking about, I guess, the same stories, schools and colleges as well? Colleges as well, okay. So the schools particularly is where my problem is, right? But FET colleges as well. What mechanism do you think, bearing in mind your experience of other countries and so on, what mechanism should we import into this system that we have currently to prevent upfront? Because what we normally find is that the wheels come off at the time when particularly poor parents have paid enormous amounts of fees, and then the kids get to school one day only to find that the place is closed down. I mean, that's the kind of worst-case scenario that you find happening. Less so now, I think previously that more and more of that occurred, but less so now. But that still happens, and it's still a possibility. What in your estimation and in your finding can be done? Because clearly it doesn't help to say, look, you know, once they registered, we're going to credit them and so on, because that doesn't help the situation. Is there a way that we can identify these schools and training colleges prior? Is the legislation strong enough, do you think, and so on? Okay. All right. I have covered nobody. let me start right from that end, right? Yes, I do. One, I'm going to give you numbers so that you can just follow immediately. One, two, three, Ms. Mangina. You've had a chance. I'm going to give people who haven't had a chance at this stage, right? Four, Mr. Khanar, is that right? So I've got four on this side. Okay, both of you had a chance. Let's hear them, and then if you're covered, then you come for a second round, okay? If you're not covered, sorry, not if you're covered.
Chairperson, thank you. I am Pontahane. No, you have covered us, but you just want to fill in some holes. Mine is on the metric results. I thought you would also touch on the metric results that each year this seem to be going down. Is it, where is the problem? The quality of schools, the quality of education, or the educators? On the quality of the content, why is the problem? And the last one is on one of your tasks is to ensure that the certificates which are issued are credible. But now, what role would you have, or what relationship would you have with universities? I understand they are autonomous. They've got their own entrance requirements. But each year with scores and scores of metric or prospective students who are turned away by the university, who seem not to trust this credibility of the certificates issued by schools. What would be your role? Thank you.
Thank you. I think it's an observation, you know, it's just a comment based on observation. The issue of SET colleges, with a special reference to the training of people who ultimately become artisans. The observation is that emphasis is on theory and not on practical work. If you go to any FET college and you look at the type of work they do there, it is more theoretical than practical. I don't want to say in the past, because if you say in the past, you are now comparing. I don't want to make any comparisons here. But we know people who became artisans would, you know, concentrate on practical work than on theory. It doesn't really help much for a person to give a very good definition of a chair if you can't make a chair. So we want a chair and not definitions. So when you talk about quality assurance in terms of training in FET colleges, I think there should be some, you know, work done in that area so that these people, if they are produced from FET colleges, when they enter the labor market, they should be able to produce something. Or another thing added to that is, I've also observed that many of these people who complete studies in the FET colleges in that area don't go for apprenticeship, because apprenticeship is very, very important. We have a shortage of, you know, artisans in this country. Now, if these people complete studies in FET colleges and then become anything else in the labor market, we are losing, we have spent money in the training of these people. I think it's just an observation. This needs to be really attended to very seriously so that we can have, you know, people with skills in the labor market. Thank you very much.
Mr. Mangina?
Okay, you partially covered me, and Honorable Pontian covered the remainder, so I'm covered.
Okay.
I think you covered me about 80%, and I apologize for arriving late. I was at another meeting. The question involves the budget. It seems as if their budget was complemented by their reserve. If they did not have the 24 million rand reserve, they might have had a shortfall if you did not don't have the reserve of 10 million. What I wanted to check is, in 2001, 2002, you had no grants from the Department of Education in terms of your report. So basically, you could have you ran the your organization without any grant from the department. Do you inform the department about your grants before you discuss the budget? That's the reason why they say you can still complement it, or you get whatever you get from the department, and then you start looking for how you can get the additional from the from your grant.
Just ask one more question. That's assuming the rest of the people haven't covered you already. Go ahead.
Thanks, Chair, once more. Just to check how Umalusi itself gets assessed. How they get assessed to themselves on, yeah, on their performance. The, their profile is more on grade 12 exams than the other areas of responsibility. And I think something needs to be done about that. Probably it's not the question. The very last, is there any agreed definition of this quality we're talking about? That yes, indeed, we're agreed, all of us, that quality assurance means this particular one. Thanks.
That's particularly why I think we need to spend more time with institutions such as this to understand exactly how they understand their mandate and how they implement it and so on. Clearly, we're going to have that exercise as well. Okay.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. I need to check. Actually, I'm checking the rationale behind moderating cuts, especially at the point at which cuts is moderated. Because it's like, it's done through a
cuts,
continuous assessment. I isn't that I was inspecting schools, so I'm concerned that if at the end of the project, somebody comes and says this cannot be the quality. If Umalusi is saying if learners pass in a great number, it's not correct, because it can be correct. So that if this moderation can happen during the process, not at the end, you know, when they've completed, they come with the mark and say, this cannot be true. The teachers were there the whole year, the inspectors were there the whole year, they say it's true. You come last minute and say, this cannot be, I'm checking.
It's the right spot for you to do that, where they shouldn't come before the end and so on. Okay. I had Ms. Kubai as well. Covered? Lovely. Anybody else? Mr. Smile?
Thank you, Chairperson. A very small question, and it relates to what you have asked in your first question with regard to the standard of quality education in our country. I just want to learn from Umalusi, what is the frequency of your advice or I would call management letters to the minister about the quality of education. Frequency, yeah.
How often do you advise?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you have all those questions, sir? Okay. Please, let's keep the answers very succinct.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and the members for those questions. I need to indicate that we will submit those reports that requested for. I'll not get into them.
Yeah.
In terms of the quality of education provided in South Africa and where do we stand in relation to other countries, we are on a continuous basis comparing our education system and our quality assurance with the quality assurance of other examination bodies like the Scottish Qualifications Authority, like Cambridge and others. And we are able to then say, this is where we stand with them. So, we can say safely our standards in terms of quality assurance are okay, they are correct. Assessment and quality assurance. What is a bit problematic is what happens in the classroom. Some colleagues have referred to what happens in the classroom as the black box. Nobody knows what is happening there because the teachers are protecting that space so that you are not able to get in.
We as a quality assurance body, quality council, we have a report that we have commissioned, a research that we have commissioned that is called maintaining standards report. That says where do the question papers that the letter wrote for the first time last year for the national senior certificate stand in relation to the old qualification senior certificate. And we are able to do comparisons there. And we are able to say this is the level and we are not happy here and we are communicating that with the Department of Education. This is one of the reports that we are also providing to the minister. Regarding independent schools, FET colleges and schools, where the problem happens and we only observe it at the end when parents have been shortchanged already. What I think is the legislation is strong enough. Our legislation is strong enough that the registering body, the department, can close down those institutions. The problem is our parents are not adequately educated to say when they go to an independent school, they must ask for the certification, the certificate of registration by the department before they can register their children. They should ask for the certificate of accreditation by UMANU. So that people will just go register their children without taking these critical issues. So that maybe we should, as a nation, establish a call center where parents can verify these things. The principals are reluctant to produce this certificate. A call center where parents can check this school, Castle Bridge, is it registered or not? And somebody should be on the other side able to say it is not registered if the parents, if the principal does not want to cooperate. The decline in the pass rate in matric, there's a lot of debate. There are papers that have been written in this regard, with some people arguing that in the 2002-2003 period, when the results seemed to have improved at that time, there was an artificial inflation of the pass rate, and that with the new leadership in education, systems have been put in place to ensure that our assessment systems are very strong, are very strong. So that is a debatable issue. And it also goes to what happens in the classroom. Is what is happening in the classroom correct? Because what we get as the end product is the result of what actually happens in the classroom. So in terms of our quality assurance system, we are sure that we are doing justice to that part. But there is a debate. There are papers that I can figure the members with that argue that the 2002-2003 period, there was an artificial increase of the results in this country. Further, the relationship that we have with the universities in relation to the qualifications that we issue is that there is full confidence in the student that UMANU issues. The difference comes when a student wants to register in this faculty, that faculty, or that faculty. Each faculty will have its own standard. Science, for instance, will have its own point system that will say for you to register for an engineering degree, these are the points that you must have obtained. And UMANU is on a continuous basis engaging vice chancellors of universities who are in charge for the academic function of the university to say where do we need to strengthen, where do we need to partner, what are we doing right, what are we doing wrong. So we have those engagements with the university. So what I need to just say briefly here is that the universities in South Africa have full confidence in the certificates issued by UMANU. Further, on the question of FET colleges having more theory than the practical, I need to indicate that the NCV qualification for FET colleges, that is new, has a very strong practical component, which is also moderated by UMANU. We don't leave these two colleges to do this on their own. UMANU also moderates that practical component. So I just want to just say that we can be satisfied with the country that we are quality assured in that area, and there's a strong and practical component in the new qualification offered in the FET college. On the question of the budget and the reserve, I need to indicate that in 2001, when the predecessor of UMANU disaster was getting no grant from the department, they were doing only one function of the function that the COO referred to. They were only quality assuring assessment, only. All these other functions like evaluation and accreditation, research, and curriculum,
they were not there. So that's why we could survive with that small budget. But at the point when the DOE came to the party, they started on a very small baseline, as indicated in the slide. And further, we do submit our budget to the DOE, and they then take it to National Service. I'm not sure of their processes. But then they come back to us and say, we can only afford this for the digital bodies, including Umaru. Umaru will get so much. Then we go back and rework the plan and look at our reserves to check how we are able to accommodate the whole year's budget. That's how it works. Who assesses Umaru? Umaru is having an independent council. I indicated earlier that we've received an apology from the chairperson of the council. And it is managed by independent people from universities and different stakeholders appointed by the minister. And it has got a fiduciary function. So those are the colleagues who check on the quality of work that we do. Further, we also have internal and external auditors who look at our work, like the CFO has indicated. So there are people who also give us some examinations to write. We also have a research commissioned by Umaruzi on quality indicators to say, for us to say, this is quality, as a quality council, what are the indicators of quality? We've got that research that we've commissioned, and we are now beginning to field test that research, to check whether those quality indicators, when you put them in practice in the field, will they give us the desired results in terms of what quality stands in our operation. The moderation of cash at the end of the year, ideally, we're supposed to do it, like the honorable member is saying, to do it at certain intervals during the course of the year, but we're having serious financial constraints as industry by the CFO. It would be impossible for us to do it at certain intervals during the course of the year. We can only do it at the end of the year. Even when we do it at that time, we also give feedback to the department to say, in terms of care, this has been the weakness, so that the remedial measures cannot be factored into the system immediately, but can only be factored into the system in the following academic year. We provide the minister with a number of reports. Just as an example, after the senior certificate examination, national senior certificate examination, NCB, we give the minister a whole report of what our observations have been with the system, what are the weaknesses in the system, what has been strengthened in the system. So the minister is getting continuously reports from Umaru. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. I know that it's been a challenging time for you trying to shrink what is obviously a huge bundle into a small bit of time. But as I say, we will come and spend more time with you, and members will be able to engage further. Minister Mangena, you want to?
Chairperson, the CEO made a rather serious statement saying there is evidence that the pass rate in metric in a certain year was artificially inflated. That's very serious. By whom and how? How was that done and for what purpose?
Can I make this suggestion? We can ask for a written report in that regard. Okay. He did indicate that there are documents to back up that. But can I suggest that we've got two other bodies that we need to engage now, from now till about 12:30, and we're running out of time quite seriously. So can I suggest we get that report? If necessary, we may be able to reconvene with them once we've received whatever report they're going to give us. Can we proceed on that basis? Thank you. Now, thank you very much. And you will let us have that that information, sir. Okay. All right. Thank you for your time. Who is up next? Oh. Can people please take up their... it's the National Students Financial Aid Scheme. Can people please quickly take up your seats?
please, over to you. Please begin by introducing yourself and go straight into the presentation for about 20 minutes, please.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and members of the Honorable Members. My name is Sipho Pityana. I chair the National Student Financial Aid Schemes Board. And with me is Mr. Pragasen Naika, who is the CEO, Mel Festus, who is the Chief Finance Officer, Linda Mtumayo, who is the Chief Operations Officer, and Ms. Bonnie Feldman, who is the Communication Person and Development. Well, we'll try and be very brief. I know that we sent a more detailed document. We'll skip some of the slides for to make sure that we cover all the various aspects. I'll ask Mr. Naika to just take us through quickly various aspects of what the scheme is about. But as you would know, this is a successor to TEFSA, and the scheme was established in 1999 as with the principal purpose of distributing loans, bursaries, and recovery of loans, including those that were administered by TEFSA before. And an amendment to the Act was effected subsequently in order to ensure that it covered the further education and training colleges which were excluded previously. The focus of the scheme has been principally to contribute to redressing the issues of access to higher education. And I must make the point here, issues that restrict access as they pertain to financial aspects, because there are other issues pertaining to restriction to access. That slide indicates how much of that we affected in the last year, and also to respond to the broad human resource development needs of the country. Recent trends would show that there's been an increasing focus in spending the funds around those areas that have been identified as scarce skills. We're aware of the big debate around what scarce skills means and whether the other areas of higher education don't constitute scarce skills in the South African context. Do you want to cover the other areas?
The main focus of NSFAS is contained in the preamble. It's a national student financial aid scheme that is affordable, sustainable, and as you can see from the example given in the 2007 academic year, 2008 academic year, an increase in funding from 1.8 billion to 2.5 billion. In the academic year, 2007, again, the number of students year on year increased from 125,901,000 to the 2008 academic year, where we supported 153,000 students. Since our inception, we have allocated 12.2 billion. Administration costs at NSFAS are pretty low, but I need to state to the House here that as we redefine and improve our business systems and processes, this is likely to increase, but as it stands, it's very low, both for territory. Functions in terms of the Act is to allocate funds for loans, bursaries, to develop criteria and conditions for granting loans and bursaries, and in consultation with the Minister to raise funds, recover loans, maintain and analyse the database, and undertake research for better utilisation of financial resources. In this regard, NSFAS has recruited a research officer who's been in place now for some 10 months, and the impact of actually having an in-house research officer is beginning to show results in terms of the research that's been commissioned and the work that's been done on our database. Crucially, This first needs to advise the minister on matters relating to student financial aid and any other functions assigned to it by the minister. This first funding sources. Department of Higher Education and Training is certainly the single biggest, largest contributor to higher education institutions and FET colleges. DOE and other government departments like Social Development, Labour, Agriculture, Eastern Cape Province make use of NISFA as an agency that manages their scarce skill funding to students for undergraduate study. We also are looking to increase involvement from the corporate sector. Currently we have one major entity that uses its scarce skill funding, it uses NISFA to attract people into scarce skill funding for its particular requirements. The core funding summary from the Department of Education, as you can see, it's made up of recoveries and also ring-fence funding that specifically targets scarce skills like teacher training. And as you can see, both in 2007 and 2008, there's been an increase in funding. DOE targeted funding, we've got Sandra Lushaka, FET College bursaries, and so on. We will talk more closely about the issue of bursaries versus general education funding. The point about bursaries is that NISFA is actually organizing and facilitating bursary expenditure on behalf of donors, and it is in fact the donors who set the terms and conditions of bursaries and not NISFA.
May I just come in on a point of order? If I think the tables are very sort of, the quality of the tables are problematic. And I know we are sort of pushed for time, but NISFA have to sometime explain or give us new tables.
Make the point that the point of the earlier slide that was presented is to highlight the targeted intervention for special projects. For instance, Department of Education contribution to disability, which is usually largely funded by the Department of Labor, and then the top up by the Department of Education, especially for those institutions that had high levels of debt, and then the Funda Rushaka, which is targeting higher education. The FET colleges, bursaries, as we indicated previously, didn't form part of our mandate, so the effect of those things. And then this particular slide highlights the contribution by the various state institutions as well as the private sector. Of importance there is the point that Mr. Naika was making about the initiative that we're trying to do to partner with the private sector. And the pilot there is the NetBank 3-year commitment of 15 million rand per annum to partner with us to to fund, to use NSFAS to fund key skills. They set the criteria, and we assist them in selecting and identifying the students. So in a sense, the figures are important, but the most important principle is to give the categories of who the contributors are.
All I'm saying is that it becomes very difficult for us to understand those things that you're reading it from the presentation that you've given us. So what we need to see what is the total pool. Okay. Of that pool, how much is state funded, how much comes from the private sector, and what those things are, and then how many of those interns were allocated. For our purposes, that's what we need at this stage. So it's just difficult to read it like that, and I'm saying to fix that up and maybe to supplement your presentation to us, you've given us something in writing on that.
Okay. May I ask the Chief Operations Officer to take us to the next slide?
Okay. Thank you, Chair. My role at NSFAS is basically to serve as a link between NSFAS and higher education institutions and FET colleges. Financial aid offices at universities serve as a link between NSFAS and students at those universities. They are not employees of NSFAS, but those of the university where they work. With that, obviously, come some challenges with regards to the administration of those funds. Firstly, it is very crucial that the financial aid office is well resourced, but due to the increase of total funding available, that has not been the case at most universities where the staff complement has remained the same. And again, with the introduction of the National Credit Act, the accuracy of information on loan agreement forms has created substantial additional work for financial aid offices. And the capacity constraints, therefore, at financial aid offices and NSFAS limit opportunities to work together to identify additional ways of assisting students. So as such, you find that at the end of the financial year, there remains an amount of money that's not utilized by financial aid offices and as well as some FET colleges. But what the board has done is has approved that those funds that were not utilized in 2008 be redistributed back to institutions where, there was a great need of funding to be made available at those universities. And again, in 2008, the Minister of Education then approved an amount of 39 million to deal with top up where universities had, spread thinly funding available to assist more students. And again, that funding was made available too late in the year. And we've asked the minister to approve that, the balance of that unutilized 39 million be redistributed back to the original universities to deal with the balances or to deal with the issue of top slicing by most universities. And again, what is done is NSFAS has written to all the vice chancellors informing them that if the institution does not use its NSFAS funding, they will lose it. For example, we've had institutions that have only used up to 87% of the total budget allocated to them. And the VCs have also been informed that each university must accurately report or account for the drawdown on NSFAS funding twice a year, that is at the end of the first semester in July and again at the end of the second semester around October. The aim is to redistribute within this academic year where there is a need. By September also, each university must account or must send 80% of their loan agreement forms to NSFAS. This will then allow us to make more realistic assumptions on unutilized funding. And we're going to enforce, strict measures that these deadlines are met. From our side, we'll send daily reminders towards the end of September, but also where we see that universities are not cooperative, we will involve the Vice Chancellor as much as we can. Again, like I said, the aim is to redirect the funds to universities needing additional funds. And like I said, again, the nurse report is authorized that we will then redistribute whatever is not utilized on time. The staff, another thing important to mention here is that the minister, again, last year approved that we reinforce the budget to support students with disabilities. Some of you may be aware that the Department of Labor has phased out that the bursary for students with disabilities, and therefore the Department of Education has taken up that responsibility. That funding includes, you know, assisting students with the assistive devices that are essential for them to study. In 2008, we supported 860 students with disabilities studying at universities. I'm on page 17. Okay. The one other challenge that's mostly faced by students at the start of the year is to pay the required registration fee. The board approved an upfront payment to HEIs for students who are entering universities without the finance to pay that required fee. Needy students are given the additional help through NSFES. The university may request up to 30% of the of the budget for the year in January, February, and March to cover registration fees, food allowances, residence allowances, etc. We're happy to inform the room that the house that of the 23 universities, 10 universities actually apply for that upfront registration fee ranging from 2 to 30% of the annual budget, and it's mostly your historically black universities. So we're happy that they're taking up this offer. The student is not inconvenienced at the beginning of the year. Thank you.
Chair, I think we'll just pass with the strategic goals because it's listed and can be read. These are the strategic goals of NSFES. What we're going to concentrate on is the e-business strategy. Crucially, NSFES wants to implement the electronic loan agreement form system and reconfigure its back office system so that the administrative burden of dealing with loan agreement forms is dramatically reduced at both financial aid offices and NSFES. The new system will provide more real-time information on drawdown of NSFES allocations, allowing for improvement in redistribution of unspent funds to institutions during the academic year. And the new system, crucially, meets the requirements of the National Credit Act and the National Credit Regulator requirements. NSFES has taken senior counsel opinion, who's informed us that we must register the advanced electronic signature with the Department of Communications. And we will do this as soon as the Communications Department sets up the modalities for such registration to take place. What will the loan agreement form do, the electronic loan agreement form do? Well, basically, it will reduce the administrative burden of hand-filling in forms and signing forms at financial aid offices. It will be sent to us electronically, and therefore, it will reduce the burden and the time it takes for the loan application process to continue. And I think that's a crucial requirement going forward, given that over many years now, or year on year, funding to NSFES has increased with largely a manual system in place. One of the other issues that we need to bring to the House's attention is that our current premises was purchased when NSFES had a staffing complement of 26 people. We now have over 68 people in the same building, and we need to actually make arrangements to move to larger premises, and there are health and safety issues around the current building given the numbers of staff that occupy it. We have talked to Public Works, and there isn't enough space for NSFES at this particular point in time, and we will be submitting proposals to lease rent alternative accommodation at the appropriate time. We're now going to ask our Chief Financial Officer to talk about the annual report.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members. Just to mention that our annual audit
for the year under review, in other words, 2809, is still in progress. Due date for outcomes of the audit is generally, is generally sort of mid-July, so we don't have any comments around that. But since inception, we have had unqualified audits. We have noted, however, in our submission to the AG that in line with an internal audit review, we have picked up that there was a regulatory breach in terms of process, and the audit committee has made recommendations to the board, and these recommendations have been accepted in terms of formalizing procurement to prevent this matter from recurring. Just to get back to the slide then, what we are demonstrating is the growth in the scheme from the prior year to the current year to 809. We can see the increase in new grants from 1.4 billion to 1.7 billion, which is a 25% increase. We then see the increase in funding for FET colleges. We then also see the increase in funds reinjected. In other words, these are loan repayments which we have received from past teachers who have graduated and who have found employment, and these monies are then reinjected back into the scheme. Just to note that repayment of loans is contingent on our debtors or our graduates finding employment and earning a minimum salary of 30,000 rand per annum. And then we also can see the total awards growth from the prior year to the current year, which is a 44% increase. The next slide then just demonstrates the growth in bursary awards, which is a reflection of the first line item is, as indicated there, that up to 40% of an original award may be converted into a bursary on the basis of academic performance, and then the growth again in bursaries at FET colleges. I think the following slides, they're all headed as facts and figures. It really is an illustration of the growth in the scheme, and we apologize again, clearly there's a software compatibility issue which we need to sort out, but the point being, we can see the growth in the scheme in terms of in 2000 we started out with 72,000 beneficiaries or number of students, and then in 2008 we've grown to 153,000, and then to note that for 2007 and 2008 numbers we've included numbers for FET colleges. Again, if we look at just the growth or the take-up of the Funzel-Sharker bursary scheme, an intervention by the Department of Education, and these bursaries are conditional bursaries. They are bursaries to begin with, but if beneficiaries do not take up posts as teachers, then the bursary is converted into a loan and needs to be repaid. And then also to show the uptake of the Department of Social Development funding, these are targeted for social work bursaries. Then repayments on student loans, again just illustrating the growth in recoveries as the scheme has grown over time. Current monthly recoveries are at 42 million per month. And then again, the following slide shows the reinjection of repayments on student loans, again demonstrating the growth. And then I will hand back to my colleague to talk about revised goals for 2009-10 going forward.
The revised goals. Basically, we want to expand the pool of funds available for disbursement to students, both in terms of loans and bursaries. Effectively managing the institutional utilization of funds administered by NISPA in any given year. I think what we're talking to here and what this speaks to is the need to reallocate unutilized funds within the academic year in which the allocation is made. There is great effort going on at NISPAS at the moment to strengthen internal efficiencies in the processing of awards and claims and ensuring that funding reaches the target population. And the quality of internal management and operations in line with the changing funding patterns. We need to understand much more effectively the impact that scarcity of funding is having on NISPAS and its operations. And of course, crucially for all of us, is the ability to communicate and manage relationships. On the communication side, we're looking to actually go to schools when students are making subject choices.
so that they are aware of both careers and funding possibilities based on their subject choices. And we think that by spreading out into schools earlier on, when students are making subject choices, we will have better uptake of NSFAS funding, and perhaps more appropriately, students who have the appropriate entry qualifications for meaningful careers and undergraduate study. So that is something that we're working on quite intensely. And NSFAS wants to actually make sure that many of its policy decisions is backed by solid research. And that's something that we're pursuing. And we do now have a research committee and a research officer. NSFAS will align itself with the recommendations of the ministerial review. The budget going forward, again, I think the CFO is going to have to talk to it, because what you're seeing on the screen is not what we have put.
Madam Chair, just to make, sorry, Madam Chair, what was that? Okay. The following figures just reflect the three-year budget going forward. If we just look at 209, it's difficult, as you said, because the numbers are not quite clear, but just in summary, it is in terms of the category of the sources of funding, core source being the Department of Education, which makes up 70% of our source of funding, and then the following slide reflects the money that necessarily injects from recoveries from student loans and interest, and that makes up 20%. So in terms of DOE and recoveries, the source of funding actually makes up 90% of the total budget for the year, and then we have the other funding components where we provide the service to other donors, and then we can just go forward to the net bank, where we should show private sector, and then the total awards versus administration. Generally, over the three-year period and going forward, we're looking at a 2% administration cost versus loans under administration. There is fairly large increase in 209 in terms of administration, and this is in line with the growth and the BPR and our strategic goals going forward. And then I think we can hand over to my colleague for the ministerial review.
Well, I guess in the interest of time, we've been engaged with the department and the ministry on a various aspects that speak to the shortcomings of the scheme. In terms of the administration of the mandate and disbursement of funds, the scheme has done well. But we highlighted a number of issues that we thought constitute serious policy challenges, which I'm sure this committee would want to be seized with as that review takes place. These include the issue of whether we fund more students and provide them less money, or we provide fewer students and give them adequate financial resources given the limitations. The other is, how do we deal with that category of students who are in your entry-level middle class and don't qualify in terms of the NSFAS means test. And when they go to private financial institutions to seek funding as their only alternatives, their parents are not credit worthy, and therefore the country loses from their scheme. In terms of public policy debate, those are issues that we think the scheme doesn't address, and therefore doesn't deal adequately with issues of access. How do we incentivize those students who complete on time? They go to university, they spend 3 years, they finish the degree. Should they be treated in the same way as those who spend 5 years at university to do a 3-year degree? We put forth some recommendations in respect of that. And we've done some modeling to look at how we can deal with those. How do we incentivize partnerships to leverage more private sector funding through partnerships between us as a state agency and the private sector, so that the pot is bigger? There's been debates about whether there is an establishment of a bank, or we leverage the fact that the financial services environment has its own charter, which seeks to partner with government on some of these things. This engagement has led, and it's one of the issues that has led to a decision on the establishment of a review, because these issues require very extensive, detailed consideration, and we think that they will contribute positively to improving the scheme. Thank you.
Look, I realize that we were not in a position to give you adequate guidelines as to how the presentation needed to be done and so on, and you've done your best under the circumstances. But as far as the financials are concerned, which is really quite critical in this particular vote, frankly, I don't understand what is going on. As far as I understand so far, it seems to me that what we need to do, and you must tell me if I'm working on wrong presumptions, okay? The first is you get an allocated amount of money, both from government as well as from the private sector. That money in turn is meant to go for bursaries and funding for scholarships as such. Now, that's your one part of the budget. The other part of the budget, which is why I can't understand how you calculate your administration costs of against the allocation, as opposed to your administration against your total budget that you get for administration, okay? So that's the other part. The part that you get for your institution, to run your institution, to pay salaries, to pay your telephone bills, your electricity, whatever. That's a separate one. And that one I want separate accounting for. So I need to see how much your salaries are, how much your expenditure is, whether you've overspent, whether you've underspent, as far as that is concerned. In that way, we can then assess and say, look, you know, we think that you're quite correct because you say you need more funding and you definitely need more funding or not. But as it stands in the presentation at the moment, I can't see that that capitalization, okay? So that's the one thing that needs to happen. The second thing that needs to happen is from inception, I need to see, of the money is allocated by government, the total amount, whether you get it from labor, whether you get it from DOE, and so on, and breaking those down, how much of that remained rolled over from year to year? So, on year one, if you were allocated 20 rand, and you allocated intern bursaries for, let's say 15 rand, you were left with 5 rand, which you rolled over to your next year, or what happened to that fund. So from year to year, let's see how that works. And I think you've tried to do that in a way in your first few slides. And if I can read this thing properly, am I correct to say that in this current year that we're in, of the money is allocated by the Department of Education, 2% remains unspent. Is that correct? Am I reading this thing correctly? I have no idea. It's not marked. So it's on your...
Is it the one with the
budget, DOE, core funding summary.
Yes. You are correct, Madam Chair.
So that's how we should read this slide, if we can read the numbers, of course, which you're going to now sort out for us. So 2% remains unspent. Now that's 2% of your total allocation of 376 million. Is that right? 376 million. What is 2% of 376 million? Was that about, Mr. Minister, 7.5 million?
Madam Chair, if we're on the slide, which is DOE core funding summary, and where the heading says budget 20708 and 20809, we're on that slide, then we have...
Don't go through the slide with me. I want to know, is 376 million, that's your total allocation, am I right? not right.
Then we're not on the same slide.
Okay. It says here, look, you've not numbered the things. Now, a lot of them have the same heading. It says budget 2007, and it's like the first part of your, I think it's, what's this little book? Fourth or fifth page. Fourth page of your slide.
Understanding is high there.
and understanding is probably relatively higher in other skills areas for the reasons that I've indicated. But broadly, in respect of the, again, we made a point about FET. In the first year that we administered FET, we had institutions that were allocating as low as 38% of what was allocated to them. Subsequently to that, our rate of allocation in FETs adjusted to about 90% and over in the second year. So it clearly shows that allocated and used. So it means that the system had improved in the second year, and we would monitor that. So we can give an account of that, of where we are. But we've got a detailed account of how much was allocated to various institutions, each institution, how much was used by each institution. That's why we're able to say to institutions, if you haven't used this money, then we'll, even if you have the need, we'll take it to another institution that has a need and the capacity to use the resources.
See, that's your job. My job is you go to them and you tell them to spend. I come to you and I say you spend. Okay? So what I want you to do is the way you want them to account to you, I want you to account to me. So I want to see, as much as you're saying, you can break it down per institution and so on. That's great, because that gives us a sense, and especially gives you a sense. I know that you know where the problems are, so that's great. But what I want to see is of government allocation, not repayments and so on. That I want to see separately, because clearly, as you say, there are all kinds of problems with those things as well and so on. And we're coming to that report that I want from you as well. But of government allocation, very straightforward thing. They give you a lump of money. They say, spend. I want to see how much you've spent. And I want to see it in a report that is quite clear. And then if I say to you, okay, well, who exactly is the culprit? Then you can show me the detail of that. But I want an overall summary of that. So I can see of the allocations, how much was spent. Of the repayments that you've got in your income stream, so to speak, of that, how much has been allocated, how much not, how much have you collected. Okay, let's go to that report while we're on there. Let me see how that has panned out over time as well. So obviously in your first year and second year, maybe even third year, you would not have had repayments. But at the point where you started getting repayments, how did, you know, what was your expected repayment? What did you actually get in? And what is the discrepancy? And going forward as well, so that I can see if there's a major problem, or at least that you're on top of whatever problems they are in that regard. On the issue of specially ring-fenced matters, we can report on those as well. And as you say, there are problems there with scarce skills. And we'd like to hear from you how you think those matters should be handled. Are we saying that it's a question of scarce skills and people are just not going into those professions, number one? And if so, then clearly there's a place where policymakers, people here around the table, need to intervene in those areas and to assist where you are basically showing us red lines. Or are we saying that, you know, you only have people who are going in there but who don't qualify based on the criteria that you have for those students? And maybe we should then be looking at the criteria and see whether we should be reworking those criteria. So it's all manner of things that you would then feed into in some of the policy work that we will be doing as well. So it's really a matter that I'm going to leave in your hands. But that's the issue of the budget allocation. That I would like to clearly so that we have members here go into the budget debate next week with some sense of whether there's been a fundamental understanding or not on government allocation. Anybody else want to just add anything to that?
Chair, we can do what you're asking and make it available tomorrow.
Okay. Anybody else now? Okay. All right. Let's take questions. I'll do a nice round. Let me start on this side. That's Ms. Kubayi, Mashishi. Let me give people their first. Ms. Madlala. I'm very good these days. okay. Let's start. Okay. Let me come back. Let me come back to those who have asked. On left, Ms. Abula. Okay. Let's ask those people who haven't asked questions yet, and then we'll give those who have if you've not covered. Okay. Go ahead.
Thanks, Madam Chair.
Oh, by the way, you've asked a question. Okay. So let me go to those who haven't first. Right? Thank you, Shepherd. Thank you, Shepherd. When they present here, they talk about that they were institutions. We didn't utilize the funds. What I'd like to know, is there any mechanism in place to assist those institutions, or is it because of lack of capacity? And then, again, what was that question? No, I'll just take the other question. Thank you.
Thank you, Jefferson. Jefferson, you know, when I'm listening to the presenters, to me this is complicated. Maybe I need a day-long workshop to understand exactly what is NSFAS doing. Because now they're saying that bursaries depend on certain categories. For instance, the presenter mentioned that students who are choosing HR, there are so many, also those who are choosing numerical and literacy requirements, and those students are excluded. I don't understand why such students are excluded from getting the bursary. Maybe it's right that we need to look into the policy itself of NSFAS as politicians. Again, here they are saying that the bursaries should. They should make sure that the bursary does go to the poorest of the poor in our population. But I'm not sure what strategy are they doing for the people at the grassroots level to understand exactly what is NSFAS doing for them. Because you find that there are students, after completing matric, they are roaming in the streets, they don't get funds to further their studies. What strategies are they doing to make our grassroots level aware of such things, of NSFAS role? Again, also on the student loan recovery. The student loan recovery, what are they doing about those students who cannot where they cannot retrieve the money, NSFAS money, because you find that the student will attend 1 year, 2 years, then he fell off, that student fell off. Then how do they recover their money back? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I'm glad that you have dealt with the issue of the unspent matter adequately. The concerns that I have around the revised goals, the expansion of the pool of funds available. My concern, Madam Chair, will be what is the relationship between the financial aid scheme and the number of matriculants that have done virtually well in school? Secondly, the ones that have done well and paid for themselves, but cannot complete their education, how is the scheme going to assist them? Finally, ma'am, what is the proportion, or what proportion of the population does the scheme target, and how is it accessibly and equitably in all of the provinces and all of the rural areas? Thank you.
terms of assistance to institutions, the chief operations officer, she indicated, works with all of the institutions. In fact, they have visits to institutions to take them through the training programs to make sure that the financial aid offices are there. We have regular interactions with the vice chancellors, and we look at, we do audits of financial aid offices to highlight the shortcomings of the scheme, of the administration of the scheme, etc., etc. We have sessions on an annual basis where all these institutions come together. In fact, this week there's one of those where there's an exchange of information on how the various institutions handle their work, and there's incentivization of those who do well. They are given awards for performance. So there are various interventions of that kind. We try also to impress upon university administrations and other higher education institutional administrators to make sure that financial aid offices are seen as important part of the university administration. I would agree with the member who said that the maybe our presentation may have been trying to cover too much and a lot of information made available. I would hope, Madam Chair, that you see fit to spend a day with the scheme as well, to get through the issues around the formula. I think is quite revealing, and as the board, we spend a great deal of time around the formula because that's where the issues about where the money goes are determined. Are we distributing this money properly? Is it impacting? And all of that. We have constant discussion about that. It's an ongoing issue, and I think it would be good to do that. But the point that is being made here is that the targeting of scarce skills raises the prospect of under utilization of the funds, because the scarce skills areas tend to be those areas which require typically maths and science, and the target population that we are looking at tend to come from schools that don't have capacity to generate those kinds of graduates. So as a result, you have the money to fund those kinds of graduates, but you don't actually have people who qualify for that kind of funding. So the example of human resources indicates that we would have more people who are available to do that, and there's not as much money to fund that because it's not it's a limited amount. Communication is one of our weak areas, and we've invested a lot of effort to try and lift that. We're not reaching as much of the population as we would like to. We send out information to all the schools, either leaflets and posters, etc. We fund a number of rural NGOs and some of them in urban areas to work with us and partner with us to communicate the scheme. We're looking at investing more resources around communication because we think that's a very important aspect of our work, and that is a shortcoming at this stage. On the loan recovery, no student who is at university repays the NASFO scheme. You only get, you are expected to pay once you are out of university. And we do this, and we're quite effective in recovery of loans because of the partnership that we have with SARS. Immediately you work, before you do a hire purchase on a car, we will be there to collect the NASFO student financial aid scheme money. So it's a very effective scheme. You don't even have to notify us that you've got a job, but it just gets triggered automatically as soon as that happens. That includes dropouts. And as soon as they get into employment, we're able to pick up to recover the money. In terms of the relationship between the matriculants and funding,
That's one of the areas that, as I indicated earlier on, in terms of the review, is something that probably would be covered. Admittedly, I don't think that there is a very strong correlation between the number of students that we fund and the kids who matriculate, and that's because there is a cohort of students who in terms of the means test, don't qualify for NSS. So we don't see the entire universe of matric graduates, but we target the poor ones, and to that extent, only those who are aware of the scheme. There may be those that may not be aware of the scheme, and therefore lose out of the program.
So, this issue that was raised by Mr. Bula, if there isn't a correlation necessarily between your matriculants, and particularly those ones who do well, but who are not, for example, in a position, although their families are working class people and so on, but they can't afford engineering fees, for example. So they go and they become HR. I mean, do we pick up those kinds of situations, or is this also a matter for review? I had a query just yesterday, for example, somebody phoned me and said, look, my son is registered for an engineering degree. I've lost my job last year. What do you do under those circumstances? Now, clearly this man obviously has a house and so on. He's now in a situation, given the global economic crisis that we have now, more and more people are falling into that kind of situation where their jobs and people have been retrenched and so on. Are those all part of the review, or are there do you have categories where you can assist people like that?
Madam Chair, no. The typical example that you've highlighted would qualify for NSS, because that would be somebody who previously was in employment and suddenly not in employment. So in terms of the means test, would qualify. And they just have to apply to financial aid scheme, financial aid offices of the institution, and they would be referred. And I must say the financial aid offices as well have other private sector bursaries that are not administered by NSFAS that are available at those institutions. Universities also have their own bursaries and loan programs. So invariably, people in those kinds of scarce skills areas who are on stream would often find assistance. But the Chief Operations Office, I'm sure, would be happy to assist. The metric example, as I said, in my view, there isn't a correlation between our funding and metric. My view is that it is highly unlikely that there will be, but it is desirable that there should be, especially in relation to those who come from poor families, and that's why this review process should assist with that. Our own research is trying to get to the bottom of that, as to who benefits and how, and why do people take 5 years instead of 3 years, and all of those kinds of things, so that we can then target the scheme a lot more. Because in a sense, if you spend 5 years where you can spend 3 years, it suggests that there is wastage. But it makes sense to spend that 5 years given our understanding of the shortcomings in the school environment. That's why we've taken the view that we'll have a 3+2 year policy in terms of funding.
Look, I'm going to ask people to be very, very brief, because we've got 5 minutes and we still have a whole institution before lunch. So let me. You can start. Anybody else on this side? Okay. Yes, sir. Okay. One, two. No, just two now. And then one. I'm getting two. Two. Right. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Madam.
You can interact with people afterwards, like they're going to be around.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One is a comment, and secondly, it's a question.
Please, can you just answer the questions? We're running seriously late, and I'll give those people that I've identified an opportunity.
Chairman, the comment is linked to a concern. It's really about the image of the fund itself, in terms of what the chairman was saying about communicating the fund. Of about 5 learners from high school, I mean from the higher education that I interviewed this weekend, there's a kind of lack of hope in terms of how they feel that people are connected to the fund. And whether that happens at institutional level, where probably you don't have the power to influence, I don't know. But for me, the learners are not really thinking that the NSFAS is there to help them achieve the goals. That's number one. Number two really is to see the numbers. The numbers linked to the success rate of the learners, so that the NSFAS is linked to a national grand plan of human resource development. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm a little worried about the redirection of funds from one institution to the other, when we know in that particular institution where the funds are taken away, students need money. So I think something must be done to really find out why the money has not been spent, because it's not the student's problem. It is the institution that really needs to explain why the funds were not used. I think this is very, very important.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. I'm treating poverty alleviation. The students go to school because they want to be poor for the rest of their life. They want to be better off in life. Now, immediately after they've completed, they must repay. And fast is helping. I'm checking if this actually is assisting the students. Because once somebody borrows you money, they ensure that you are poor for life, you know? Such that, I don't know if we can talk of getting a fund in the future, which will do away with. You don't come out of college with a debt. It doesn't take us anywhere. Thank you.
We charge our World Bank interest rate.
Thank you, Chairperson. NS was doing a very important job of allocating boundaries to our destitute. I just want to check with you your visibility within our community. Where are you operating from? How many offices throughout the country do you have? Thank you, Chair.
I think this interface issue is clearly a huge one.
Just to say that in terms, we only have one office. I start with the last question, Madam Chair. We have the last we have one office, and it's in Cape Town. Our branch network is wherever you have an institution of higher learning operating through the financial aid offices, and also we seek to expand that in the work that we do with several NGOs who've got a formal network with us, and we ask them to. We'll share with you, by the way, Madam Chair, the report that we did on the NGO partnership, because it was quite revealing of the network that they have, the counseling that they give to students, the performance of the students that go through them, and all those kinds of things. I think it's something that we're looking to use to expand and work with. But there is no doubt, as I said earlier on, we are not where we should be as far as communication is concerned. We are not as visible as we should be, and as a consequence, maybe a lot of students are losing out. And that's a shortcoming that we're working hard to address, and I hope that we'll get more ideas and suggestions from members as they debate this as well. On the redirection of fund, Madam Chair, I'm going to steal your language. will not come here and you ask me why I would not spend money and not have answers. It's all very well to be needy, but you must have the capacity to use the resources that are directed at you. Now, I think that this is our approach is that this is a ballroom dance of two. It's NSFAS on the one hand, on the other, it's institutions of higher learning. If they think it's important to ensure that there is funding to their students, then they must provide capacity and infrastructure to receive support for those students. Because once we take over that responsibility from them, they will never exercise their own responsibility. That's why we put pressure on them, and when they don't use their resources, we take them away from them to other institutions, but we engage with them to ensure that they put institutional arrangements in place so that they have capacity to use money next time we provide it. And in every institution, there is there's supposed to be a committee of student representatives, the university administration, the financial aid office, to oversee the administration of these funds that we allocate. And every time we say to all the stakeholders that they must make sure that the money allocated to them is indeed used and used effectively. If we take over that responsibility from them, that situation will deteriorate. So we, taking the money from them is a very strong leverage that we have to get them to come to the party. Unfortunately, on the loan, NSFAS is not 100% loan. Even where we give loans, it's often a percentage of the scheme. It's 40% of the scheme. We only recover it once a person is in employment. We don't chase them around before they get into a job. And the interest rate on that loan, by the way, is 80% of repo rate. So it's not 80% of prime, it's below repo rate. So it speaks to the mission of NSFAS. So we give you 60% grant, 40% we must recover it. And that, as you can see from our budget, is a very important component of sustaining the scheme.
Well, thank you very much. What you must please just do is just leave your contact details with my secretary. What we will try and do is to organize a visit to your office, at least a site visit at some stage, because you are in Cape Town. And maybe within the next few weeks, those members who are available, we can just go over there. And we certainly will have a full day session with you on some of these issues. But please let us have those reports as soon as possible, okay? Council on Higher Education, please. Let's hear about your funding constraints.
Thank you, Chairperson. Honourable Chairperson and members of the Portfolio Committees, I'm Dr. Cheryl De La Rey, and alongside me is my colleague, the Chief Financial Officer, Dr. Jan Bierkes. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Council on Higher Education, and I report to a council. The Chairperson of our council is currently Professor Mangane. Chairperson and all the members are appointed by the Minister. Chair, I've planned about 20 minutes of presentation, a very short section on the mandate and who we are, followed by a much longer section on the budget and how we utilise the funds. To start with, the Council as an organisation is in its 11th year of existence, and it was established by virtue of the 1997 Higher Education Act. It took about a year to get it up and running, and therefore it's 11 years. In terms of our mandate and areas of responsibility, what we do is advise the minister, and in terms of the act, it specifies that we must do so on request and we may do so proactively. Just to give you an indication of the kinds of advice we've worked on very recently, since the beginning of 2009, we submitted advice on a draft distance education policy. We're currently working on advice, also at the request of the then minister, on the use of the title university in the private higher education sector. In terms of advice we've delivered of our own accord or proactively, at the beginning of this year, we submitted advice on institutional autonomy and academic freedom. The next area of our responsibility is monitoring the state of higher education, and specifically monitoring the state of the higher education system against the achievement of policy objectives. We are about to complete a report which reports on the past 5 years. The report is due to be published at the end of July this year. And for the first time in our existence, we've tried to cover information on the private higher education sector as well as the public higher education sector. This has proved to be not very easy because we don't have good information on the private higher education sector, but together with SACO, we're putting in place a system so that in the future when we present to this committee, we'll have information on that sector and what's happening there. Also, with effect from June 2009, we now function as the Quality Council for Higher Education. That was covered in part by an earlier presentation from SACRO, but I'll say more about that in a moment. And finally, we contribute in general to the development of higher education. And what this means is we conduct research on higher education, specifically higher education policy and its implementation. We run workshops and we host conferences, and in terms of the Act, we must host at least one annual conference. This year, it's likely to be in Cape Town. It's a public conference, and we normally pick a theme and focus on a specific theme. Chairperson, in terms of the Higher Education Amendments Act that was passed in 2008, as I said earlier, we function as the Quality Council for Higher Education. And what this means is that we're responsible for qualifications, quality promotion, and quality assurance. The part which you see in a different color, in other words, it's in a brownish terracotta color, is what's new in our mandate. Everything else was there before. So the emphasis on qualifications, and here I would like to specify that what this means for us is that we are now responsible for implementing the Higher Education Qualifications Framework, which is a sub-framework of the National Qualifications Framework. And what we require to do is set and generate standards for qualifications. We must firstly do some research, but then be responsible for the naming of qualifications, and we are generally expected to provide advice to the Minister on the Higher Education Qualifications Framework and its implementation. Now, with respect to who we are, Honourable Chairperson, we have a relatively small staff. Currently, there are 45 staff members. Since its establishment, the Council on Higher Education has had a high number or a fairly high proportion of unfilled vacancies. And I was appointed just over a year ago. We've looked into the situation, and the information we have suggests that compared to both the public and private sectors, our remuneration levels at the management level are below, and that's one of the reasons we're struggling to attract staff at those particular levels. For example, one of the gaps in our current organizational profile is that we don't have any HR management capacity at all. It's done by myself or the CFO. As I will say in a short while, we're not able to deal with that due to budget constraints. In terms of the future, and this was indicated in the business plan that we submitted last year, I would see that over the 5 years ahead, the Council on Higher Education should not grow to more than 75 people in total. I don't think we should ever become a large organization, but at the moment, as I speak, we have 10 posts vacant, that's excluding the area of responsibility that was conferred upon us by virtue of the recent amendment to the Higher Education Act. I haven't counted those in the total number. If I do count those, it would go up to 60 posts. Our equity profile in terms of race, I'm not sure if the colour is visible enough, but just to summarise what the picture is, as we go up the hierarchy, we will see that at the senior management and director level, that's where the race proportion is not in line with the national demographic. And again, it maps directly onto the vacancies we have within the CHE currently. In terms of the gender profile, except for the senior levels, we are a woman-dominated organization. I now turn to the budget. Chairperson here, once again, based on questions I heard earlier, if there's any information we haven't submitted, we'd be happy to do so as soon as possible after this meeting. But this first table is an outline of the budget. Firstly, what I've specified is the budget that we submitted in September last year. It was a request for a government amount of just about 41 million. As of February this year, the amount approved was much lower than the amount we requested. But what that 41 million did not cover was the request we made in a different process to cover the new mandate area. So if we had to add on the amount we estimated for implementation of the new mandate area, that would be about 6.3 million onto the 41 million, the total amount would have been much higher than we requested. But as we stand, we have the 36 million, and that's what we're currently trying to manage with. Just to go back, you will see that the request for the new mandate area, the request for year one was higher than in the subsequent years, and that was simply to cover the initial setting up costs. And we saw that after setting that up, the cost of running it would decrease. The request of 41 million plus the additional six for the new mandate area, we had planned to focus on the strategic areas that are listed on this slide. I will briefly outline what we wanted to do with respect to each of these strategic focus areas. Firstly, Chairperson and members of the committee, we would like to do a full assessment of the current capacity of the public higher education system. And in this project, we have begun to look at the issue of the differentiation of the system. At the moment, we're working with two groupings within the higher education sector, a grouping of five universities, and what those five universities have in common is that currently they're largely rural-based. But historically, they also have in common the fact that they are ex-homeland universities. And we're working with them in developing a strategy based on being almost wholly located within a rural area and having to deal with the challenges that come with that location. We're also working with the South African Technology Network, and that's the grouping that's formulating a strategy for universities of technology, specifically looking at the question of what is the role of universities of technology in meeting the human capital needs of our country, and how is that role different from the more traditional universities, for example, the comprehensive or the more research-intensive institutions. So that's a project that we've begun and it's underway. What we haven't really started is looking at the total capacity in terms of the demand, and what we would like to do is assist the planning for higher education on a much longer-term basis. What will our needs be in 25 years' time, for example? Many other countries around the world who have successful systems plan on a very long time horizon. For example, a country like Japan has a 100-year plan for higher education. We tend to plan much more short-term, and I think that's not in our interest to do so. We would hope to get there too, Chairperson. We currently have a cluster of projects on curriculum responsiveness. The first one is about to, we'll end this project at the end of this calendar year. We took up the question that was put to us by the then Minister of Education, the question of whether the first and general bachelor's degree should be a four-year degree or a three-year degree. What we have found to date is that there's a clear need for curriculum reform. What we're currently working on are what are the critical factors in a curriculum that we are able to leverage in the interest of improving both the quality of students and the number of students who graduate in the designated time. We've also started a project looking at the doctoral degree and the way it's currently structured. We then have a project on community engagement, and broadly speaking, this is the question of what is the appropriate contribution of higher education, but specifically public higher education, to national and specifically national economic and social development. As we speak, every university has tens of projects in place, but we're trying to work with them to develop a framework and a set of indicators so we can demonstrate to both Parliament and the public what the contribution of our sector is. In the interest of time, I'll move on, looking at the next generation of scholars and specifically what do we do to increase the qualification level, the productivity, and the demographic profile of the current scholars in our system. We have signaled that we'd like to start a project on funding and accountability and specifically re-examine the conceptual basis of funding for higher education and public higher education. We inherited a dual system where part of the money, the competitive grants, go through science and technology and then the block grant through another department. And more recently, there have been earmarked grants allocated, but we want to look at the total system in terms of the medium-term needs and the longer-term needs. We've again just started a project looking at the impact of globalization and how we approach internationalization of our system. The bulk of our current work, though, is on quality, and specifically quality assurance and quality promotion. And the quality assurance system that we're currently running takes three forms. We do national reviews, and the one that was most covered by the press was the review of the NBA some years ago. We do program accreditation, and we do audits of the quality assurance systems of institutions. Go directly now to the budget. This is the historical picture. I draw members' attention to the bottom part. When the CHE started, it initially started by virtue of funding allocated by a number of donor organizations. But sometime later, the government grant was instituted and continues to this day. But what the picture shows is that we are primarily dependent upon the government grant, although we do have other sources of income, but they're relatively small. This is a picture of how the state allocation versus the expenditure. And if you look at the bottom line, that's the government grant, the line on the top is our expenditure, and there's clearly a gap. And we cover the gap between expenditure and the government grant through the forms that I indicated on the slide previously. As we go forward, we expect, we are planning to increase the fees that we charge to private higher education institutions for program accreditation. This does not generate any surplus for us. We simply charge it on the basis of full cost recovery, but we're trying to develop a better system for calculating the cost of that function. This is how we allocate our budget. The breakdown per function, but specifically I'd like to draw your attention to the fact that the new mandate area is not in this pie chart. These are the functions that we've always had. There's the advice and monitoring, the quality promotion and quality assurance. And in the slice that's referred to as corporate services, what we have in there is the IT service, the finance department, the cost of all our office costs, cleaning, maintenance, that entire cluster, and quite a significant proportion of salaries.
But what's not indicated here that I would like to mention is that if we calculate our total staffing cost, 54% of the total, and if we portion out our total administrative costs, it will come to 38% of the total. Again, this is a way of depicting the allocation for the medium-term expenditure framework and how we would use it over that three-year period. Chairperson, we have been working on our non-financial performance indicators, so I included this slide. Gives the members an indication of what it is we actually do, and we try to improve the way in which we measure these various functions. So the first one is the number of academic programs that we assess, the number of accreditations that we would hope to complete, the number of improvement plans. Just to explain, once an institution has been audited, they receive a report with a list of commendations, what they're doing well, and a list of recommendations where they should improve. And after a given time, we expect to receive from them an institutional improvement plan. And then the approach is in place to monitor the implementation of those improvement plans. I won't go into further detail, Honourable Chair. With respect to a request for advice, the numbers in here are based on the recent past. Depending upon, we really can't predict how many requests we'll get, but we must respond to everything. In terms of managing the budget on a quarterly basis, we usually try to manage it in a way that allows us to respond to requests as they arrive. In terms of the proactive advice given to the Minister, in the last while it was only the one on institutional autonomy and academic freedom, but in the 09-10 year, all of those strategic priority areas that I referred to earlier, we plan to give advice for each one. We have implemented a database of researchers. We don't do primary research ourselves. We rely on a number of other researchers research, and then we interpret the information, and we now have a database of all the researchers working on higher education, but also in the area of education in general. We also hope to increase the number of publications that we distribute, and you'll see that from 08-09, we're targeting 2,000 publications to be distributed in this period. Chairperson, in conclusion, it is my view that as the Council on Higher Education, we are capable of increasing our impact in our mandate areas. But the one constraint we do have is the budget. And as I've tried to show, I believe that the request we put in last year was a realistic request. And our biggest concern at the moment is the implementation of the new mandate area, because we don't have the resources to do that. But we certainly have the willingness and hopefully the intellectual. Thank you very much.
Mr. Bernardi, in any case, sent me a little note to say that on this issue, they are engaging Treasury at the moment. Mr. Bernardi, do you want to speak to it, mate? 2 minutes.
Honourable Chairperson, I don't want to waste your time. I just want to say we're on an advanced stage of negotiating with National Treasury, and we are full of hope that the budget issue will be addressed very soon. We cannot give guarantees at this point in time because we do remain in the hands of Treasury, but we are very hopeful. Thank you.
Hope is all Treasury gives. Okay, members, I thought that Dr. James would want to follow up on this particular matter. It fits very nicely with the question you've been asking all the time about the 21st century and what do we mean by education for the 21st century in terms of the
Thank you very much. I was going to ask a different question. Just to say, if I was a minister of higher education and training, which I'm not, what would your advice be to me in terms of how to produce better quality and more graduates in the sciences? And just to say, and this is my opinion, that our existing universities of technology are in fact not universities of technology.
There are some, in fact, that don't offer biology at all. And that what there are very good technical colleges, and some departments border on university standards. And also to say that there are many countries that have a dedicated university for technology as a freestanding institution, as opposed to putting more money into existing science faculties at universities. But anyway, the question is, how do we grow this in the course of time?
I'll ask the question that that Dr. James didn't want to pursue, which is this, and he raised it twice, I think, in the committee now. As far as the strategic vision is concerned, and to develop a plan for higher education, let's say in the next 20 to 30 years, okay, we don't know, we're not Japan, we don't live that long, so 20 to 30 years is about right. But I was reading an article which basically said that the future our kids are facing will be essentially three things. It will be a hotter world because of global climate change. It will be a more crowded place, and it will be a hungry place. Now those, for me, just kind of sum up a huge, huge challenge that will face not just this country, but every single country on the planet in the next, let's say, 50 to 60 years. And the question is our education system as a whole, and not just talking about higher education, because obviously it starts from now to primary school and so on, but is our education system geared up to talk to issues such as, just take the issue of food security, for example. Technology used to grow more food, more efficient, more efficiently, more sustainably, and so on, more in harmony with our environment. I certainly don't see that kind of impetus coming out of any particular country, frankly, when it comes to the issue of education. At the moment, when we have these hearings, focusing on things like math and science, quite, you know, understandably so, because of our past and because of this animal called apartheid education, we clearly have to rectify those imbalances. But equally, it would seem to me that one of the things that you need to include in your curriculum very, very soon, particularly at school level, is agriculture. How do we teach? I mean, one of the ravages of apartheid has been to break down our societies, our families, and so on. And rural communities have moved into urban areas and lost that indigenous knowledge on how to grow food sustainably, because that's the community that you came from. That's the indigenous knowledge that people acquired over centuries and centuries of living in harmony with the land. At the moment, what we do is we mass farm, and we're in danger of salinating our land. So, you know, those kinds of things, I mean, it's just the most incredible thing that we don't seem to be, there don't seem to be an urgency preparing for that kind of knowledge-based system that we need to reintroduce. And we have it in our grasp as third world countries, really. In the first world countries, you forget it. There's no way Canada's ever going to grow food, you know? They don't have the climate, they don't have the know-how, frankly. But it's in the third world countries, particularly in Africa, where we need to harness these education systems and really apply it to the 21st century needs, that they don't seem to be, I would say there should be a movement, a campaign towards that. What are your thoughts on this issue? That's assuming other members don't want to contribute. I know you want to contribute, that's why I'm listening.
Not that much. I think the other question is what you have been raising and was raised by the doctor at the other time. But what I wanted to as well check on, which was also raised in our meeting last Wednesday, was on the dropout rate, which was said to be, my recollection is correct, was that 50% or so, although it was being argued. And at that point, my question was, where did we get the figures? Are they official? You know, who are supposed to give us the official figures of where, or
what is the status in terms of the job rates in Zimbabwe.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me start by appreciating the strategic focus of the Council, I hope that you will get the money so that you can achieve. Chairperson, I think the first point, the assessment of capacity of higher education system, is important. And also the differentiation that you talk about. Now, I think, or I would like to believe that you are looking at these institutions to become centers of excellence. That's why you assess them, so that you can improve on that. Now, I do have and you will allow me, Chairperson, I will now put on my ethnic jacket for a while to ask, at University of Stellenbosch, there is a sort of a problem, I would imagine, with regard to the Afrikaans thing. And that, for me, it may sort of have problems for that university to maintain the position of being a center of excellence. And then I would like to ask the question, what are you doing? Are you contributing there to make sure that things are not going to disarray? And also, there is a position from PRAF, it's an NGO, Dan Root, I think, he is advocating for two, in terms of, and I'm talking against the background of differentiation. He's talking about two Afrikaans universities, which was also advocated by Professor Herbo, to say one in the south and one in the north. What is the position of your body on that? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I am sure the committee will help that you get your allocation as a question. Yeah, I was saying I am sure the committee will help the presenters get their budget as a question. That is not the question. I'm observing with fear that when the communities are very young, they come together, they stay together. Immediately they go into the administration. It's about age. It's about age because of so-called culture. What is are you doing in other parts of this problem?
Thank you, Chairperson. To start with the first issue regarding what would I say to the Minister of Higher Education and Training on the matter of more graduates in science and technology and better quality graduates. Before I answer, Chair, I would like to say that what is the process within the Council is that I craft the advice for the Council, and only once the Council agrees do I submit it to the Minister. But in this case, I'm giving a view without having done so. But what I would do is firstly look more seriously at the question of differentiation of the system, as Dr. James himself has alluded to with respect to the universities of technology. It's differentiation in terms of professional areas covered by the curriculum, but also the levels within that curriculum that we must look at. But the research that we're doing on the curriculum is giving us some interesting insights. For example, if we look at the international information and now we're doing the local data gathering, it suggests to us that to improve the quality, we must try to ensure that every student has at least one opportunity to be
be in a small class of students. In other words, where there's one lecturer for 25 students. And it seems to make a critical difference to the quality of the learning experience for the students and the quality of the graduate in the end. Many of our students don't have that experience. So there's a matter of the student-lecture ratios in our universities and how that is managed within a faculty or department. Other critical success factors we're looking at is how much time the students actually spend on the learning challenges. And when in the academic year do they begin to focus on the educational challenges? What we're finding is that in many of our institutions, month number one is spent on student induction without being presented with a critical academic challenge. So to put it simplistically, Dr. Dan, after the first month, well, the student will come in and is quite apprehensive about this institution. You know, am I up to it? But after the first month, the student concludes this is a great experience because what they've been mostly doing is having fun. But what we think we may wish to advise the minister in the future is that in the first 2 weeks of exposure to a higher education institution, aside from the fun, there needs to be critical academic challenges put to their students. We're also learning that what happens outside of the classroom is critically important to the quality of the educational experience. So the quality of the resident life, the clubs and society, all of that whole experience needs to be seen as part of the academic experience and not as extracurricular. So I think it's going to require us as a sector to have a bit of a mindset change on how we regard student life. There's a critical contribution to academic life and we shouldn't see it as separate, as I think in many cases we have. So I believe that the research will give us some insights on a number of changes that won't necessarily cost huge amounts of additional money, but certainly the student lecture ratio needs to be looked at. As part of our ongoing work, we focus on the quality of the teaching and learning, and we will have to move towards closer monitoring of the quality of teaching and learning within our institutions of higher learning. It's not we have one part of the responsibility, but within the institutions themselves, they would benefit from better information on how to identify at-risk students earlier on so that the appropriate measures are put in place, and it's not only the end of year one or year two or even year three when the student discovers that they're not coping as expected. Over the past few years, the then Department of Education has invested quite, I think, substantially in the infrastructure of our science laboratories and so forth. And I think that will make a difference. And now we need to tackle the curriculum issues and the people issues. And that's what I refer to. The question on the future of higher education and are we addressing the current and future issues with the urgency it requires. Chairperson Yair, if I could refer to the National Research and Development Strategy, which is under the auspices of the Department of Science and Technology, and the most recent release of the Department of Science and Technology's 10-year strategy, they have highlighted some key areas which cover some of the questions you've raised. But having said that, I think far more needs to be done because the question you put to us is also about the curriculum. And here I'll go back to the earlier question. I think in our curricula, and it's related to class size, is that there's a clear, in my view, a need for more inquiry-based teaching and learning methodology. And we don't have a sufficient focus on inquiry-based right from the entry level. We tend to focus heavily on research at the postgraduate level, but I think for us as a nation to address those issues, we must develop the research capacity more than we currently have, and there needs to be some changes to the curriculum to ignite the interest in answering these questions.
questions that confront us, and specifically the questions that confront us on the southern tip of Africa. But having said that, it's also linked to what we're trying to do together with the five rural-based higher education institutions. For example, the matter of food security and migration from rural areas to urban areas. The direction we're taking in those discussions is that our strategy for rural-based higher education has to be aligned very tightly with the National Rural Development Strategy and the anti-poverty strategy. We can't do it as higher education alone. If we look at a number of other countries, and many South Africans have had the opportunity to travel to U.S. and to be enrolled in U.S. Institutions, what we see there today are a number of very successful top-ranking institutions that started out as what we call land-grant institutions. And the original mission was really about occupational training in key areas in that state. But they took the view, and it's my personal view, that those institutions must also have a research focus, but the kind of research they focus on will be different. And so that's the general thrust of what we're doing, address a cluster of issues around rural development and food security. And in those conversations, we do have in the working group the CEO of the Agricultural Research Council and a number of the other research bodies, because we ourselves need better coordination amongst ourselves as public entities. Many times people say there's not enough coordination at government level, but I think the same can be said of us, and we must take responsibility for that, and we're certainly trying to do so. On the dropout rate, the information that we get, in fact, is the Department of the Higher Education Management Information System, popularly known as HEMIS, and that's managed by now the Department of Higher Education and Training. But we don't at this stage have sharp enough data on dropout rates to know, and also to be able to answer clearly questions about why is it that students, and there are a number of students who are seemingly performing well academically, but still do not complete. And we've got a number of smaller studies doing more qualitative work on those questions so we can answer you better in the future. At this stage, we don't. The Department in Management Information System keeps the broad quantitative information, but we need a qualitative research now to understand the reasons for dropouts. With respect to the issue of language, there is strong international research that supports multilingualism at every level of the education system. And here, again, it's not something the council, as a council has discussed recently, but the council some years ago published a report on multilingualism, and I can make that available to members of the committee. But the essence of the research is that it's important to support indigenous languages. But what we're seeing increasingly is, by choice, students will enroll for courses offered in a language that's going to facilitate their future career success. And that we're seeing in the patterns, even in the universities. In our process of auditing institutions, we collect information both from the institution and other sources of information. And what we're seeing is that it's important to recognize that we support our official and indigenous languages, but we must accept that for career advancement and to fully participate in this 21st century knowledge economy, there is an economic utility of certain languages, and at the moment that's English. And we see it in the choices that students are making for courses, and when they have the opportunity, what they choose as the language of the examination paper. So it's a dual responsibility, and it's, in my view, not simply about Afrikaans, it's about all our languages and how we support multilingualism
in the country across the higher education system. The if we have the will to do so, we also have to back it by the resources, because it does take resources to implement. There's no doubt about it. But so I would generalize it to all the languages in answer to the question, not simply an Afrikaans issue. A further question about the culture of institutions. The report by the Ministerial Committee on racism and other forms of discrimination concurs with what we are learning from the institutional audit. Every institution in this country of higher learning has a cluster of transformation issues to deal with as part of their institutional culture. There's no institution without that. And it's a reflection, I guess, of the broader society. But what we have to do, and what we are certainly doing, is looking at the university curriculum in the broadest interpretation, resident life, sports, clubs and society, student governance, and the classroom curriculum itself, is what can we say in the future to the Minister of Higher Education and Training by way of supporting overcoming those divisions that we currently face.
I take it that is an ongoing thing, because the last thing I want is another scandal and videotapes and so on. And if that does happen, clearly, you know, one of the places we're going to be looking at is your institution. I think this is the gist of what this is. So we're hoping that you're doing so very, very seriously and on an ongoing basis.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to, I suppose it's self-interested, let me be frank about it, but what we do is we have to stay within our mandate. On the matter of transformation of the system, we have in place a number of indicators on transformation in our State of Higher Education report. We include, as part of our ongoing activity in advising the Minister and submitting advice, all matters related to transformation. We promote the discussion and the development of strategies to overcome these forms of discrimination through our conferences and workshops. But where we have no power is with the implementation in the institutions themselves. There we're limited to engaging directly with the leadership of the institutions.
That's certainly the case. All we're suggesting at this stage is not an issue for the back burner. It's quite a crucial issue and an element that really is fundamental to the normalization of our society. Thank you very much for that. It's precisely about 2 minutes after 1 o'clock. Thank you all for being very succinct in your presentation. And I know that this has been the first time you're engaging with both committees and things were unclear and so on. But we do hope that we will sort out a lot of these pitches as we proceed. I think once we get used to how we require you to account and so on, we can do a lot better. And certainly in the next budget hearings, things will be a lot smoother. You'll have a lot more time to prepare and we'll engage before that time as well. Members, I do want to thank you all for your patience yet again. And the questions that you posed, I think they're very interesting and made for interesting sharing on my part. May I just, as a housekeeping thing, remind you that next week on Tuesday we don't have a committee meeting because our budget vote is in the afternoon at 2 o'clock. No doubt all of the institutions would have been invited and so on. By that time we would know whether Treasury has just given you hope. In which case that will leave us with a lot to say in our speeches, which is good news for us, not so good news for you. So please remember next week Tuesday that there's not going to be a committee meeting. But what we will try and do sometime next week, hopefully, is meet on a committee report. He is busy scribbling it down here. When do we hope to do it? On Friday, the 6th. We have to do it by Friday. So we may have a short meeting on Friday just to kind of do a small little one-page report, really, on the 2 days of hearings that we've had. We're not going to raise too many issues. It's just really a formality. As I said to you, we're really pressed for time during this budget hearing. So the draft will be distributed to your pigeonhole. You can have a look at it. And really what we're hoping to do on Friday is literally to just correct, pass the report, and go. All right? So you'll get some notice as to the time and so on, but I imagine it'll probably be at about 9, around 9. Okay? But you will get a formal notice in your pigeonhole. Then Tuesday we have the budget vote, during which time that report will have to be on the APC. And then we'll also try and organize a little trip to the offices of the Student Financial Aid Scheme. So we'll see how that pans out. I'm not quite sure where the physical address is, but if it's close enough, we can just walk there. Otherwise, we'll just try and accommodate each other in our cars and so on and try and arrange for a short just on-site visit so that we can see where the place is and meet the people who make it run and so on, okay? All right, and then the following week you will see that there is a slot for a meeting that is to be advised. One of the possibilities would be the Auditor General's report. The problem is we're trying to get hold of somebody from the Auditor General to actually take responsibility for that report. There seems to be some difficulty getting hold of somebody there who can actually come to the committee and brief us on the contents of that report. We'll also be in touch with the department to make sure that they come with their response to that report as well. So that's on the cards, but whether it'll happen next week or at, not next week, the following week or at a later slot depends on who we can get hold of, at what time, and so on. But if we don't do the Auditor General, we'll try and get something else on the cards. We still have to have a broad discussion on where we want the committee to go and so on and so on. But I thought after these hearings, things would gel a little bit more and people would have better ideas and so on. Okay? All right. Any questions on the program going forward? Okay. Then we stand adjourned. Thank you very much for your time. Thank you.